Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Need office supplies? At OfficeStar247.com, you can compare their prices to the national stores. OfficeStar247.com has lower prices, free delivery, and no minimum order charges. OfficeStar247.com. They compare, you save.
Award-winning night call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Hey, thanks a lot, and welcome to the broadcast. Our number is 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. And if you're listening for the first time, show's been on the air for a little while, but you may be just catching us for the first time. It's a talk show. We value your opinion. So if you'd like to express yourself, give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. Why do I say we? This is not the royal we. I do not have a mouse in my pocket. Jalene Jordan is with me. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter. Good to be here. Yeah. And yeah, the show has been on for a little while. And
I think it started in 1970.
Wow.
Yeah.
Long time.
Well, I went to the Gringo Beer Fest last night.
The Gringo Beer Fest?
I think they call it Cinco de Mayo.
Okay. But, where all of the white people go out and drink tequila.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was out in it last night myself.
Yeah. What is with guys that they stand there and they go,
yeah, it's some kind of grunting, guy thing.
Right then.
I saw a lot of that last night.
Yeah. Well, never mind. We won't go there.
We'll move on.
Yeah.
This was more important issues.
This is an international talk show. In fact, if you're listening in the Detroit area, via the internet, we go all around the world, all around the country. So the reason I hesitated there, what Jalene is not going to talk about, was a station event right here at WRIF.
Yeah.
Interesting,
time.
Though. On the way to work, I was thinking, wow, the prices are down. It was only $3.06, but what you said prices were what, $3.26?
$3.26 is
gallon.
What the 6 o'clock news said. In Ann Arbor, there was a place that was $3.26, but good old Citgo over in another part of town is under $3 still.
Well, you realize what you're expressing, right? This is sort of what they want us to do. I mean, I agree with you. I'm thinking, wow, $2.99, I can go over there.
Yeah.
We're thinking, now that's a bargain. And that's the way they sort of play with us, right?
They do. And how we are so absolutely, I don't know what the word is, but we're just kind of used to the idea at this point of gas being near $3 a gallon, where it's just not that big of a deal. It's not a shock anymore.
Yeah. Well, they remember when it went over $2 and everybody went a little nuts, and then it kind of went down, and then down for the elections. It was almost, in fact, it was up to $3 right before the election.
$3.05.
Then it came down, and now it's going up past $3, and people are barely grumbling. So we're really going to grumble when it hits $4.
And it is going to, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they'll bring it down to $3.25, and we'll say, hey, it's $3.25. It's Citgo.
Ooh, bargain day.
Right. Well, of course, what the Bush racket is doing, they're proposing to lease out millions of acres along the coasts of Alaska and Virginia to oil and gas drillers. Now, I know this is going to shock you, Jalene, but these are also people that have contributed extensively to the Bush machine.
No.
Yeah. All right.
I mean, I just continue to be so shocked by these things.
Well,
the oil, the bushes.
Yeah, I guess they don't. I wonder what they think the penalty is. In some polls, like the Newsweek poll, Bush's popularity is down to 28%.
Yeah.
There's one, I guess, it shows at 34. But all these things that are going wrong, all the exposures of this corruption and cronyism and incompetence and the war and everything, and are they just going doom, 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 doom? You know, who cares?
Yeah, so disgusting.
We're going to roll back this longstanding ban on drilling in these environmentally sensitive areas because they use this in so many ways. First and foremost, of course, it brings enormous profits to their buddies like ExxonMobil that keeps having record profits. And people say, well, the cost of crude's going up. But how many times do we have to say this? I'll say it one more time. If their costs went up and the price of gasoline went up accordingly, their profits would be the same, right? But if they're gouging us, then their profits would be astronomical. And I wonder about some of these conservatives who will eat anything that the rich and the powerful feed them, no matter how bad it smells, no matter how ugly and unpalatable it is. They always say, oh, yes, yeah, that's really good. And sure. And of course, then all of a sudden they become these monsters when they turn on the critics. You know, I'm going to crush you.
Lots of anger there.
Yeah, well, but to the boss, they're just little meek puppies,
right,
you know, right?
Yes. And you know what else they do? They watch that damn Fox News, and it validates all of their insanity.
Well, they do.
Yeah.
I mean, there has to be some way. They're in a polemic against reality. Yeah. And so.
And they say the French are out of touch. The French have no real dependence on oil.
Yeah, well, now they're just ecstatic that this right winger now has just won the presidency.
Right, that socialist babe didn't win.
No. And they're just thinking, whoa, if only all of a sudden I'm blocking on his name. What is it? Wait, don't guess. We'll be bad. It's a Kauzi. Kauzi. I'm guessing.
See, I sound
ridiculous. but they're just thinking, oh, if only he would have been in there in 2003 instead of Chirac, then the French wouldn't have been cheese-eating surrender monkeys. Of course, everything that Jacques Chirac, the president of France, said was absolutely right about the war.
Yeah.
But let's see. Where I had this. Here. This is from Robert in Port Huron. He said, my dad is an over-the-road truck driver, and he passed this message along to me. He said, I'd like to share it with me. In April 1997, there was a gas out. That is, people boycotted the gas pumps on a particular day. And he says his father told him gasoline prices dropped 30 cents a gallon overnight. On May 15, 2007, so that's coming right up, all Internet users are asked not to go to a gas station in protest of high gas prices. Gas is now over $3 a gallon in most places. And I've seen this identical email in a number of places. Robert says there's 73 million American people on the Internet, and the average car takes about $30 to $50 to fill up. If all the users did not go to the pump on the 15th, it would take, that's almost $3 billion out of the oil company's pockets for just one day. Now, I wonder, though. I mean, I'm, Robert.
So what do? You go fill up the day before?
Well, yeah, or the day after.
Right.
So doesn't it really...
I mean, I understand what they're trying to do.
Collective effort against oppressors.
We're all for that.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So we'll do it.
I'm going to be in the East.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So,
you're leaving me.
Yes. I'm leaving you the show.
Yes.
So next Sunday, it's going to be the Peter Werby Show starring Jolene Jordan.
All by my lonesome.
Yeah. And also, but I'm going to rush back for May 19th, Saturday, May 19th.
Oh, yeah.
Which is?
Well, my band. I have a gig at the New Way Bar in Ferndale. For those around the country and the world, I wish you could be here. But
yeah.
I do some political stuff, and it's going to be a good time. So come on out.
So, yeah, it'll be on my website. I should already have that. But I'll do that. Yeah, I'm taking
Thank
off
you.
For a week. And so we're going to go to...
Vacation?
Yeah.
Good for you, Peter.
Yes. I'm the what do they used to call? The hardliest working man in show business.
Right? I think that's an honor.
Because, as the Marxists said, workers of the world unite. We say, workers of the world relax. So I'm going to do that. But it's hard. I mean, I don't mean to throw that in anybody's face because, in fact, now that I said that, I feel a little badly because people are just being squeezed so much to work more and more for less and less, and they're fearful about layoffs, understandably. And when you read about these companies like Citicorp or something like that that lay off 17,000 workers, it's not like they reduce the work. They reduce the workforce, so essentially it's a speed up for everybody else.
Yeah.
So I didn't mean that, I don't know. I certainly
do. We just think you're working too hard.
Yeah, you are.
In society as
you are.
In general.
United States workers in the wealthiest country in the world, at least with the largest aggregate wealth, also has the workers, middle class and working class, that work the most of the industrialized world. So most of the wealth we produce winds up in the hands of the ultra wealthy. I mean, that's the whole game. So there's lots of ways you could distribute wealth in this society. And one of the things is you could have, say, 30 hours a week, 40 hours pay. That would mean we'd have to hire more workers and people that aren't working or that are paid, that have had to, forced off of jobs and had to take jobs that pay a lot less.
Yeah.
They could be working. Well,
can you imagine the uproar?
Yes. In Bush's Walter Reed Hospital, cockroaches are okay. Mold is okay.
Sure.
Filth is okay.
Yeah.
Vermin is okay.
Hurry on.
Folk singer Joan Baez has been banned at Walter Reed Hospital. Isn't that sweet?
It is. It's really sweet. Now, she was invited by John Mellencamp
right.
to come and perform for the troops, and and they said, no go, you cannot come to this hospital. I mean, like, Joan Baez is a threat. That's like the monks that we marched with at the big protest we went to in Miami. Like, they're a
threat. The Buddhist monks.
Yes.
Yeah, right. John Mellencamp told RollingStone.com, they didn't give me a reason, being the Army, that why she couldn't come. We asked why, and they said, she can't fit here. Period.
Good answer.
Right.
Good, well-thought-out answer.
And Joan Baez, and you go to joanbaez.com, I think. Yeah, it's Joan Baez. That's Baez.com. Buy her records. Go buy whatever she has. Go to her website. I mean, that's one of the ways you deal with censorship. But she wrote, I've always been an advocate for nonviolence, and I have stood as firmly against the Iraq War as I did against the Vietnam War 40 years ago. I realize now that I might have contributed to a better welcome home for those soldiers fresh from Vietnam. Maybe that's why I didn't hesitate to accept the invitation to sing for those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. In the end, 4 days before the conference, I was not approved by the Army to take part. Strange irony.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, she's out for nothing but good for this world. And that's just gross. I don't like that story.
Couple other items here. Heather Mariah loves the personalized license plate. She must be, let me see, Rapid City. Where is it? North Dakota, isn't it? Aren't you?
It's up there in one of the Dakotas.
Yeah, you're like, isn't that one of your neighbors in Iowa or something? Or,
I don't know. Well, don't equate me with South Dakota. I'm not a fan of that.
Right.
Their government.
So she loves personalized license plates on her silver Prius, which encouraged the impeachment of President George W. Bush.
Really?
But somebody doesn't agree, and that somebody complained to the state. Now the South Dakota. South Dakota Division of Motor Vehicles is trying to recall her plates, which read MPEACHW. So it says MPHW. And if Mariah doesn't turn them in voluntarily, the state is going to send law enforcement officers to pick them up.
No. I mean, why are they so threatened by a license plate?
Well, she says, I don't think I'm going to play. She said she'd be inclined not to cooperate. The plate isn't in poor taste. It's not sexual in nature or pornographic.
Right.
To me, a political message should not be considered offensive. Believe it or not, I'm a little mixed on this. I would not like to see a lot of right-wing slogans on license plates,
yeah.
Or maybe, what the hell, let it all hang out.
Yeah, that, you do make a good point, though, Peter.
Yeah.
I mean, like, can we just leave one thing alone?
Yeah. It says, the law clearly gives the state authority to recall the plates, and the head of Motor Vehicles Director, Deb Hilmer, said, I'm following the letter of the law. It's offensive to someone and not in good taste and decency, and the plates are the property of the state of South Dakota.
Well, get out.
Yeah. There are others, cases all around the country, though. The website, ITMFA, that's ITMFA.com, has stories of other states in which impeachment plates were recalled by the particular state in which the people lived. ITMFA stands for impeach them already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So it's ITMFA.com.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah. Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers fame says it was the threat of impeachment that got Richard Nixon to bend to pressure from Congress to wind down the Vietnam War. This hero of that saved thousands of lives by exposing the lies of the Vietnam War says, if you want to move Bush on Iraq, he says, get serious about impeachment. Millions of Americans are doing just that. And, you know, the Democrats are saying, no, it's off the table. Oh, no, we don't want to do that. That's too radical. You know,
oh, yeah.
We do not want to do this.
You see a lot more yard signs impeach Bush these days, though, even on my street.
Yeah.
I was so happy to see that.
One more. You know, it's odd I saw this because I was thinking about Don Imus. Remember that? That's like Monica Lewinsky.
That was
almost
so long ago.
Don Imus, you remember him? He had the blue dress with the spots on.
No, you have it mixed up.
Oh, no, that's right.
I wonder where that dress is.
Yeah, right. And how much it's going to fetch on eBay.
Right.
By the way, if you want to jump in at any point, 313-298-WRIF. And if I... Do you remember what the numbers are? How come we can't do this after all these years? I can't.
Like 9743.
Yeah, you're good. 313-298-9743. This is
what a rocket memory. Over
yeah, here. Yeah. 313-298.
I've only.
Are you complimenting yourself or mocking,
years,
or mocking
so.
Me? Anyway, one of the things Imus is suing CBS for like $40 million.
Yes.
And I couldn't care less. I mean, people said, you know, Imus is going to get all this money. Well, who cares?
I think he is going to get it.
Yeah, well, it sounds like they violated his contract. But in any event, he's pretty generous with a lot of the charitable work that he does. So it's kind of a win-win situation.
Yeah.
You know, a big media conglomerate gets busted. He gets knocked off the air with his horrible statements he was making for so many years. And maybe some kids with cancer will get help. So, but I was thinking about what he said about that thing about nappy-headed hoes. And I was thinking, everybody was so understandably offended.
Yeah, sure.
But then I also thought it had another characteristic of it that was so strange. Here this man is watching this footage of this incredible ball team.
Yeah.
This Cinderella team that was, it lost its first seven games and almost won the NCAA championship. And he sees color. He sees the racial characteristics of somebody, which we always talk about race as a social construct because, you know, some people have blue eyes, some people have blonde hair, some people have dark skin, some people have light skin. And it only becomes important in a racist society, the hue, the shade of one's skin color. And this is what this guy sees. I mean, he is a twistoid.
Yeah, definitely.
Particularly when people are beginning to move away from that considerably. And one of the reasons for the indignation is that sports is supposed to be pretty much race-free.
Until someone slips up.
Well, here's Rush Limbaugh. I usually don't even like to mention his name.
Oh, no, but Peter.
Now, this is kind of complicated because there was a cultural critic in the L.A. Times that wrote a piece about Barack Obama, the presidential candidate, mm-hmm. senator from Illinois. And it was called, let me see, where is this here? Oh, yeah. Obama, the Magic Negro.
Oh,
yeah?
My.
Yeah. Now, that on the face of it's kind of offensive, but then it's this whole literary thing. And, of course, you know, Negro was the accepted term before black became prominent in the 60s and the 70s. In fact, it was preferred. In fact, to think about old-fashioned terms like the NAACP, colored people, I mean, that really sounds ancient.
It sure does.
And Negro was a little stronger and always said with a sense of racial pride. And,
right.
And it was proper within journalism and what have you. But it's really an antiquated phrase. I don't want to get into the whole thing about that. But anyways, this column by this David Ehrenstein is this whole thing about literary stuff and racial stuff. Limbaugh picks it up, and he says, I'm going to say it over and over again. So he mentioned it on his show 27 times, and he says, I'm going to own the phrase. And he starts singing Barack the Magic Negro to the sound of Puff the Magic Dragon.
He is so repulsive.
I know. So, again, here is somebody. We're going, wow. You know, 30, 40 years ago, the only people that ran for president were white men. In a country that had women in it, that had African Americans in it, Mexican American. We have a Mexican American, Governor Richardson of New Mexico, who's also running, a long shot to be sure. But so this is all gone. This is like the future. This is the American Revolution that extended the concepts that founded the revolution, which began with extending its properties and its definitions only to white propertied males into everybody. And there wasn't, there's not a distinction based on those, those sort of superficial characteristics. What were your gender, your sexual preference, your race, or racial origins, or anything like that. So here is this creep, Limbaugh, that appeals to the worst emotions of the worst people in this society. People that are so 20th century and 19th century and 18th century and 17th century, whereas most of us are trying to move into the 21st century or have. And
we call that evolving.
Yeah. So what he
does, please do it.
and why that he is so repellent, as you said, is that he legitimizes the worst impulses of the worst people.
Yes.
Which is why he has the listenership, because he gives permission for people to still not only think awful thoughts, because I don't care what the hell that you say. One of these guys somewhere. I mean, in fact, I remember I sent you that. I don't know if you got that article about shock jocks.
Yeah.
One of these morons that they quoted. I can't remember what his name was.
The Jersey guys.
No, an individual was a comic. He said he expected to get fired. He said words don't hurt.
Oh right.
Is this guy serious?
Yeah. He said that because words don't hurt.
Yeah.
It is Nick DiPaolo.
I never heard of him.
Me neither.
And I hope I never do. Yeah. All right. We got a lot of callers. 313-298-WRIF. Let me try it. 313. Tell them my eyes are closed.
They are.
298-9743.
Yes. Hey. Good job, Peter. Got it.
The mind's still there.
You're still in there.
All right. This is, I don't know what to say about this call. It's Mike from Birmingham. Mike, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. You're with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Peter. I guess today I was over at this party store picking up a bag of potato chips when I noticed there's in the line waiting to be in the payout line, there's this guy standing in line. He was wearing a leather jacket. It said Leather Vets on the back of it, and then on the front of it, it had this American flag, and underneath the flag was a caption that said, "Try burning this one, a-hole." It actually said that.
Do you think this guy may have anger issues?
Oh, well, I guess. And then I noticed it, and then he gave me this look like he was about to tear me to pieces.
Ooh.
Well, that we have so many angry men in this society, maybe angry women too, but women don't tend to act out their anger as much. Well, I think they always say that women tend to suppress it. I know you don't. You're looking at me. You have sort of this angry look on you.
No, I don't.
I don't. But, yeah, wow. I mean, talk about 20th century flag burning.
I'm not talking about 20th century. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
Well, flag burning is what Congress always brings up when they need that go-to
the Republicans
issue.
Yeah, the Republicans. Well, and then these lame-ball Democrats like Hillary and all, they vote for it because they know it's not going to pass and all that, and they don't want that coming back. I mean, that's why she and John Edwards John Kerry, all voted for the Iraq War. They knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They knew Bush was lying and all that. But
yeah.
They all had presidential aspirations, and they didn't want this thrown back at them. So this is real. Rather than principled politics, this is opportunism.
Yet it is being thrown back at them.
Yeah.
By us.
Right. Thank you for your call. In fact, there's a great Joan Baez. We were speaking of Joan Baez, who was banned from Walter Reed Hospital. Maybe she would see all the cockroaches and mold and filth and vermin and say something about it that is still there. Actually, Secretary of Defense Gates wants to close Walter Reed.
Really?
Yeah. See if you can get me back to what we were talking about. Let's see. Flag burning. I don't know. I lost it.
Phone call.
Phone call. Yeah. I don't know. Good try. Here's Rob. Not Rob's really. In Westland. Rob, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good. Thanks.
Good. Yeah, it looks like that first email that you read off kind of stole my thunder because I wanted to announce about May 15th myself.
Well, you know what? I'll bet you thousands of people have joined the broadcast since I read that out. Say it again. It won't hurt.
May 15th, they're holding a national gas strike where you don't fill up. I'm going to go one step further. Besides from driving to work and going and actually driving at work because I drive a semi-truck, that's all I'm going to do that day.
Okay.
I'll try and conserve as much fuel as I can. And I know a lot of truck drivers that say that their whole terminal is actually going to shut down for the day.
Wow, that's great.
No kidding. So
I think that will make a big impression on this gouging that they have going on. And hopefully that will get the hint.
Hey, Rob, one of those big rigs get a gallon, particularly when it's hauling a load?
My average right now is 7.2 miles per gallon.
Whoa.
I fill up twice a week at about 100 gallons per fill-up.
So.
And right now we're paying right around $3 a gallon.
Oh,
so
man.
About $300 to fill up twice a week.
And that.
And I run local, so I only run maybe 200 miles per night most.
Well, yeah, eventually this is going to cause inflation, too, because if you're talking of so much moves by truck, and if all of this is added to the price of transportation, at some point the retailers are going to have to make it up, right?
Well, the thing with my moves, since I move medical trailers, you know, everything gets passed along to the insurance companies, it gets passed right back to me when I have to pay my premium. So.
All right. Well,
yes, when it does come to retail, everything, I mean, that's why groceries cost twice as much for a cart of groceries now than they used to.
Well, let me tell you this, Rob. In France, when there's been these big rises in gas prices, the truckers not only boycotted the gas pumps, but they also created huge blockades with their trucks. Now, of course, I'm not advocating.
That might be going a step too far. I might go as far as... is holding a day for calling off or something like that, sort of like the blue flu.
Well, yeah, it's sort of, what do they call that in Europe, a general strike. All right, thank you very much, Rob, but May 15th, no gas, good idea. And, let's see, here's more on the gas boycott. It's Ryan in Auburn Hills. Hi, Ryan, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, hi, Jalene. How you guys doing?
Good.
Great.
Yeah, about the same thing, about the May 15th, no gas at the pump.
Yeah,
you're going to join in?
Oh, heck yeah. I got the email passed out to about 40 people on my email list. I'm hoping they all join in across the nation.
You know what? Maybe I shouldn't politicize this, but I have this tendency. I'll bet you're going to find some conservative website, or even like I was talking, Rush Limbaugh. He's going to urge everybody to go to the pumps,
yeah.
And they are going to say, that's what I mean. They are so beholden to the rich, and they are so afraid to buck them that they won't even act in their own best interest. I mean, Limbaugh doesn't care. He's a multi-millionaire. He got, what it is, contract was a third of $1 billion for
what?
10 years. Yeah, he got like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's only, maybe $235 million.
That's all.
Yeah, you know, I read about it in the paper because I was going to say, look, I will do it for $100
million
and you will save $135 million. And initially, he's more popular than I am, right?
He shouldn't be.
No, he shouldn't be. All right, May 15th.
Like 5 million.
No gas. Thank you, Ryan. Let's see. Let's see. I promise you, I will not say "let's see" again during this broadcast.
Is that your crutch word?
Phrase? I only use it about 14 times in 5 minutes. Here's Tommy in Wayne. Tommy, hi. You're on the air.
Good evening, Peter, Jolene. How are you doing this evening?
Doing great.
Good.
Doing great.
That's good. I'm just calling in to touch with some local issues about this economic depression Michigan's in.
Okay.
My personal status, I've been out of work now for over a year and a half, relying on the system, and my lady's carrying me on her back. I got resumes in everywhere on these Michigan Works talent banks, and they seem like they're not working. They seem like a real bad joke. And I look for work every day. And it seems like everything's getting more economically crunched for the middle class of the life I'm trying to hold on to. And it's turning into a third world poverty status in this state. All my buddies I grew up with in the ages of 30s and late 30s, they're out of work from the big three. and I've never seen it this bad in my little years on this planet. And I just wanted to know, what good is it right now if this governor cannot move anything with the Senate majority leader Bishop in there,
Republican,
blocking everything? Yeah, and on the heels of that statement, what is Nancy Pelosi trying to do to fix the situation with Iraq when Bush, they already knew, is going to get vetoed up there anyway? And I'm not trying to mix the apples with the oranges, but it seems like these Republicans, they just don't get it. They've done killed the American people.
Well, if the money spent so far, I have an article here somewhere, and I'll get to it a little later. We've already spent, of our tax dollars, $500 billion on this fiasco, this disaster, this catastrophe in Iraq. And at the same time, we here at home have enormous problems. Michigan probably is in one of the worst shapes of any of the states, but a lot of the states are having to cut back on services to the people. And we all pay these taxes. This $500 billion came from nowhere else except for you and me and the rest of us. And rather than being spent on us for what we need, the way to take it in and then redistribute it in terms of social programs and needs and roads and schools and stuff like that, it gets sent off to Bushko's friends. I mean, that's why this war, all the things that I called it, it's also a racket that benefits people enormously. I mean, all you got to do is say Halliburton, right? And then you understand where this is all gone.
The whole thing's like a powder keg about ready to explode in this country. It's not even summertime yet, and the gas prices, it's like, Jesus, appalling. I'm not afraid of too many things in life, the elements of God, water, fire, wind. But, poverty does not discriminate, Peter. And one thing I see of all the different races and colors out here, food and the survival of life to go to the grocery store, it's price gouged. It seems like they don't want us to exist except the rich want to exist. So I thank you and good evening, guys.
Thank you, Tommy. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. We were mentioning earlier that in South Dakota, a woman was informed by the state that she had to return her vanity plate that said MPHW. And Dave from Dearborn writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. A man in Florida received a vanity plate that reads atheist, which was approved by the state. People complained about how offensive the plate was, but the head of the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles sided with the vehicle owner and refused to recall the plate, saying that the driver has the right of free speech. He says, P.S., the war on terrorism should be against the terrorist in the White House.
Mm. You know, my favorite show on Friday nights, even though I never watch it live, but I did catch Bill Maher on HBO, and they were talking about how we need to take that whole phrase, the war on terrorism, and change that, get that out of the system now. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Where did I just read something? Maybe it was something from him about in the sense you can't even have a war on terrorism. You have wars that are like between states. All these, even the Democrats, but the Republicans even more so, McCain and Giuliani and all that, they all want to increase the war budget.
Yeah.
So this will be hundreds of billions of more down the rat hole.
And, you know, there's only, they say on the show that there were only like 400 terrorists or something like that. And they're all in Iraq.
Well, Carrie,
so we're fighting 400 people.
With Window Explorer has encountered a problem and needs to close. We are sorry for the inconvenience, except I don't have Windows Explorer open. Anyway, Carrie writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'll tell you what pisses me off, she writes. I just saw this bumper sticker with an American flag that says, "This family votes pro-life." Ugh, she says.
Oh, yeah. Those kind of send me through not kind of. They very much send me through the roof of the car.
Huh. Well, you know what? The only thing that POs me is that the way they've been able to capture that phrase, pro-life.
Yeah, as if those who are pro-choice are anti-life, which is just couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, as I've always said, what they should say, this family votes compulsory pregnancy.
Right.
Yeah. And enforced by the political state, which will Oh,
that would be a long bumper sticker, Peter.
Yes. Well, I see one of the things that happened is our little screen that gives us who's on.
Yeah.
It disappeared. So we'll take a break, and we'll be right back. Yeah. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talkyes@yahoo.com, and I'll tell you about my website, which I haven't mentioned. I don't know why I'm being so sensitive to criticism, but I'll tell you about that when we come back.
Okay.
Yep, I pressed the wrong button now.
This is WRIF.com. On 101WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I don't know why, and joining me, Jalene Jordan, I don't know why I didn't mention this right out of the box at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm going to play an interview and some music from the 2007 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, Patti Smith.
Nice. And you interviewed her this week.
Yeah, I did.
And she's at her home in New York.
Yeah.
And she called Detroit home for many years.
She did. She lived here from, she actually corrected me on the recording, but she lived in Detroit. I couldn't believe it. From 1979, when she married Fred Sonic Smith, the rhythm guitarist for Detroit's MC5 band, and lived, and then he passed away, I think, in 1994, and she lived here till 1996. And I never ran into her the whole time, but I interviewed her at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Awards in 1999. I remember that.
Cool. You know, I saw her play down at St. Andrews once. She performed, and, you know, she just is down and dirty. She spits on the floor, and, you know, and you're like, wow, I want to be like her. She's so cool. But how is she in an interview process?
Oh, she's great.
Yeah.
But she, I didn't hear her spit once.
Yeah,
so wait a minute.
Save that for the stage.
So you're going to be playing Saturday, May 19th
yeah.
at the New Way Bar.
Yeah.
And you really admire Patti Smith. So are you going to spit on the floor?
I'm not. I don't do the spitting thing. I tried it once, and I just didn't get a good reaction. Just kidding.
Good. That's good.
I have other things up my sleeve.
All right. Now, let me get back to my website, peterwerbe.com. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. I got a couple remarks. People said, how many times are you going to say Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com?
Really?
Well, yeah. Well,
are you annoying them? Or
I guess. I guess it's annoying. Well, here's what. I'm not. I don't sell anything. And this show goes by pretty quickly.
Sure does.
And I've got a lot to say. You've got a lot to say. You, Jalene, you, the audience. And but what's on the website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B.com, is this tremendous amount of information. It's labyrinthine, actually. I mean, you could spend forever on it. And I'm not bragging because all I did was copy and paste, you know?
Yeah, yes, but you have so much. You could spend, hours and hours.
So, I mean, I want people to go to it because, if I could just say, like, johnsmith.com, I wonder if there must be a johnsmith.com.
There's got to be.
Yeah. But then, okay, but I always have to spell it out because people, so, I don't know. I'm being,
right.
I don't intimidate
your name
easily.
Is rather unusual.
Yeah. Remember, I'm always telling you that don't worry about criticism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let it roll off your back,
yeah.
Jalene.
Yeah. Right. Here's Doug in Ontario. Doug, thanks for making our show international. Hi, you're on WRIF.
How are you?
I'm good. Where are you calling from in Ontario?
Well, the Ontario problems, of course. We've got them all.
Right now, what city are you calling from?
Tilbury. We're 30 minutes.
Yeah, I know where Tilbury is.
Yeah, it's a pretty good place.
Yeah.
But just, you guys think you got it all, and I think we should take, first off, all our troops right out of Iraq. We've got our own oil. We all know that. And
well, wait a minute. There's no Canadian troops in Iraq. They're in Afghanistan.
Same but different, right?
Well, in a sense, yeah.
You know, same but different. Bring all our boys home. Every time I turn on the news, everybody's complaining about the U.S. guys and the Canadian guys over there, and why is that? And, you know, I hear about the gas in the United States being $3. You know, we're paying $5.62 a gallon.
No, I know. Yeah.
You know, so it's half of this, half of that.
Well, I'll tell you, Doug, I've said this before, and I've never got a lot of agreement from Canadians. Canada does not need an army. It's an expense that's absolutely unneeded. And when people, although most people like the Canadian health system, which is a single payer paid for by the Canadian government, right now, and I mean, I know there's lots of problems with it and people have to wait more than they want, Canadians actually have a choice of having a military of the size that it is, and with this, with the Prime Minister Harper, of increasing it in size and being more, you know, the junior partner of the United States and suffering casualties as they are in Afghanistan, or they can have a excellent, best in the world healthcare system. Now, there are countries without a military. Costa Rica does not have a military. It has a national police force. And you still keep the Mountie.
You can't get an abortion.
We're in Costa Rica.
Right.
Right. But in Mexico City, you can. Mexico City just made abortion legal in the city,
really?
Which is kind of strange.
Yeah.
And so the only places that you can get abortions in this hemisphere legally are Mexico City, the United States, Cuba, and Canada.
Really?
That's
okay.
It. The rest of the time, it's back alley.
Yeah. Know?
All right. Thank you so much, Doug. I appreciate it. So, isn't there ever any Canadians? I mean, it's always like a matter of pride. We have to have our military. Well, screw that. You know, look at the problem. Well, I don't want to get too far with this, but Canada, the only country, last time we talked about this, I said the same thing. The only country that is ever going to invade Canada is the United States. And I don't think that's on the agenda. But I'll tell you, in 1970, when there was this I can't even remember what the FLQ stood for, like FLQ, something Federation, the Quebec Liberation Federation or something like that. And there was martial law declared, at least in Quebec, maybe in all of Canada. I have to go back and look at the history books. But at that time, things really looked dicey. And believe it, at that time, Pentagon planners were saying, all right, get out our contingency plans for the invasion and occupation of Canada. Because that's what the Pentagon does. They don't want to be caught flat-footed.
Doesn't it just sound ridiculous?
Yeah. Although they were caught totally flat-footed in Iraq, of course. Remember, they were estimating that it would cost, that we'd have to lay out $50 billion for the invasion. Now it's cost 10 times that, half a trillion. And when all the costs are added up, they estimate that it will cost us $2.2 trillion. And I emphasize us. I don't mean the United States. I don't mean America. I don't mean the United States government. I mean us, you and me. Because this $2.2 trillion, or if you want to really lowball it and say only half a trillion, all of that, as I was saying earlier, could have been used to make us and other parts of the world a good and decent place to live instead of making Iraq a hellhole based on nothing but absolute lies. All right, thank you. I already said thank you. Was that Doug? Whoever?
Yeah.
All right, a lot of people want to talk about the gas protest, the gas boycott on May 15th. And one of the things when you address it, if you're on hold, tell me whether you think it'll be effective. Because as either I or somebody brought up, we're going to wind up buying gasoline either the day before or the day after. So tell me what you think the direct effect this is going to be. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Where are you calling from? Chris, hi. You're on the air. Hey, Chris. All right, dude, I hear you like heavy breathing. Oh, man, I didn't mean to do that. Call back. I meant to put him on hold. I was showing you, Jolene Jordan is going to be doing the show in my absence. I'm taking a unearned vacation.
Yeah, one day, one night.
Yeah, and I'm going to be off one of my exotic trips.
You were showing me what I need to do to get the phone calls on the air.
And I
screwed it up.
It's
a little different than a regular rock and roll air shift that
right.
I also do here. Here, I rock and I talk, Peter.
Yes. Hey, I like that. Here's Tiny in Roseville. Tiny, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi, Peter. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Hi, Tiny. Good.
Hey, my thing is that, first of all, I think if we're just going to boycott one day, it's not going to work.
Right.
But like you said, everybody could buy gas the day before, buy the gas the day after. The internet piece of literature I got was about boycotting ExxonMobil and how if we boycotted the biggest, how they would have to drop their prices. In turn, everybody else would drop their prices, and therefore gas would be $4 a gallon this summer.
You know, being that concentrated makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not trying to boycott a day. You're trying to boycott the big boys.
Right.
I think that's a good plan. We've been saying that for a long time, and it's good to always remind listeners of that.
Well, you know, the right wing has this boycott on against Citgo Gas because it's a distributor of the Venezuelan National Oil Company, and there's something to be learned from that. I don't know whether they're having any effect. I don't think so.
Well, when you're cheaper than the rest, and even those who don't know it's Venezuelan oil are going to that.
Sure.
Pump, you know.
But I think that ExxonMobil, which is the poster boy for rip-off gouging, is the guy. What did now I can't even remember. Remember the guy that retired? He got some extraordinary retirement.
Yeah, a couple hundred million or something.
Yeah.
100 million parachutes, yeah.
Well, how much was it?
It was a couple hundred million. But the thing is, they're the ones laughing at us, telling us, oh, well, you know, we know gas is going to be $4 a gallon this year, and we made, I think it was $33 billion profit last year. And
yeah.
Much more money they're going to make this year.
Yeah, and when we finally get our backs up and start doing something, then okay, they'll drop it a little. All right. Thank you, Tiny. Appreciate your call. And let's see, more on the gas boycott from Chris in Detroit. Chris, hi, you're on Night Call. Go ahead, you're on the air. Maybe I didn't. I'm sorry. Wait a minute, Chris. I'm laughing because I was instructing Jolene on how to operate the system.
Let's hope I do okay.
Yeah, and I'm totally screwing up. Chris, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good.
Talking about the gas thing, I just think people are kind of missing the point on it because a boycott of ExxonMobil or a boycott in one day is fine. But everybody's going to have to buy gas from somewhere. I don't think anything's going to happen until people just stop buying as much gas.
What did you think about our last caller? He said that if we boycotted, for instance, if we boycotted ExxonMobil and actually could exert enough pressure, which, I mean, that's maybe we'd have to think about whether that would actually happen. But if we did, and they said, okay, all right, we're going to lower our prices to $260, that would, and then everybody would go to ExxonMobil, right?
Well,
even
I
the politically motivated.
Point.
I think, though, if you're talking tens of millions of people, enough people won't get the email, you know, don't get the note about it, and it won't really have any effect.
Well, I know what you're saying. I'm a little skeptical about it, but I don't want it to act as what they call a self-fulfilling prophecy. Say it's not going to work and then, you know, not do it.
It's like, you know, prescriptions. A friend of mine told me, you know, Julian, that Walmart has those. They're $4 now or $8. And you know what? I mean this. I would spend $50 at my Walgreens by my house rather than go to Walmart. So I think it just depends on where you stand and how hard you stand for it.
All right, Chris, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And here's Cynthia. Cynthia is in Pinckney. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was calling about the conversation you were having quite a bit earlier about President Bush and the war.
Yeah.
And... you know, I'm not sure where I stand. I'm kind of teetering on the fence, I guess.
Come on over. Come on over to...
On the fence of what?
Well, the thing is that the whole Democratic and Republican kind of outlook that's been, I don't know, kind of directed in one direction or another from each party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I look at it as if in all presidencies throughout history.
Yeah. Cynthia, can you turn your radio completely off?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, I think it would help you.
I'm so sorry.
I think it's throwing you off. Yeah.
Yeah, I've never done this before.
That's okay.
Oh, well, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. You know, not that my opinion matters, but I'm like a... Your
opinion matters.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm kind of like a lower middle...
Matters.
Well, yeah.
Right,
so
now,
you,
especially.
So, yeah, so you're part of this constituency that makes up, you know, tens of millions of people. Listen, I don't want to... You don't need me to lecture you, but one of the things that the rulers try to, even in a democracy like this allegedly is, they try to make us feel like that we are powerless, that what we say doesn't mean anything. And what, you know, I rarely use this phrase because it's so kind of new age, but we got to think about empowerment, and we can't do much. Cynthia from Pinckney all by herself doesn't have much power, and what you say in a sense doesn't mean much. But if we get together with other people, and there's thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of Cynthias and Jeffs and Johns and Mikes and what have you, well, then all of a sudden we're part of a community of people and of thinking that says, you know, we don't want the world to be like this. We don't want our communities to be like this. We want change. We don't want to be always frightened. We don't want always be robbed of the wealth we produce and have it just turned over to this military-industrial complex.
Partial percentages or partial votes. We vote for the people around us who we kind of have no choice.
Well, you know, we were mentioning Joan Baez earlier, and she has a wonderful song that probably most people are familiar with it through the Rolling Stones. It's called Salt of the Earth. And there's a line in there, say a prayer for the stay-at-home voter. You know, I'm probably missing some. They give you a choice of cancer or polio.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, back to my...
Thank you, Cynthia. Thanks for
Cynthia.
Calling.
Call and
us
you
again, too.
Matter. You
yes.
know, in France... My country that I am always talking about.
Yeah.
This is my country. I'm an American. But I do admire the French for a lot. 85% vote over there.
That's amazing.
Where we can't even get 35% of our population to vote in this country. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, I don't know. They sure got out for this last one.
I'm sure we're going to get an email tonight saying, just go live in France then.
Okay. Here's Jeff in Fowlerville. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing great.
I have a comment. I'm a Marine Corps veteran, so I get Legion magazine. And I'm reading in their latest issue about the Citgo gas, the Venezuelan government, and how they're supporters of Hezbollah. And I was just wanting to hear comments about that.
Well, I don't, they're not supporters of Hezbollah at all. I don't know. I mean,
I
look, Hugo Chavez is a pretty wild character, but he's one of the few governments in the world and a leader of a government that's actually taking as much of the money as possible and sending it back to the people rather than just looting people. That's one of the reasons that I'm going to buy Citgo gas. I mean, I don't, you know, the Hezbollah is connected to Iran, and Chavez is making a mistake, in my estimation, by embracing everybody who he sees as being opposed to Bush. So he kind of cozied up to Iran and this President Ahmadinejad, which I don't, you know, like I said, I don't think is a good idea for him. But I'll tell you, I mean, I've been in Venezuela, and I've been, and there, gas is 14 cents a gallon.
Is it? Oh.
Yeah, and it's cheaper, gasoline is cheaper than water. I mean,
my
if you
gosh.
Think how much a gallon of water is.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I get the, you know,
yeah, what is it, like at least 39 cents?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
That one of the things that's happened, all this stuff that everybody's going crazy about, Chavez about. If you forget about him calling Bush the devil and all this stuff, I mean, it's interesting and funny and stuff like that. Or it's you know, it could, if you support Bush, it could make you angry. And think about what are the real consequences of what's being done in the world. Well, he just nationalized, he being Chavez, just nationalized a good portion of the international oil companies that exist there, that work there. And so what's he doing? Is he lining his pocket like so many U.S. allies have done over the last 100 years? No. This is all being sent back into helping the poor of Venezuela. It's a third world country with grinding poverty, terrible housing conditions, terrible problems with medical and food, and he's the first president in Venezuelan history that has actually made an effort to turn things around. Hey, do this for me.
You know what? It's think about this.
We can't do this because
okay.
I was going to say, Jeff, please hold on because we got to get these spots in before midnight.
Oh yes.
Yeah. So hold on. Let me see if I'm doing this right, not kicking you off the air. Yeah, I did it. All right. We'll be right back. Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10. Exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. WRIF.com.
Me.
we're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Remember, 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to be playing an interview I did earlier in the week with Patty Smith. Joining me here on Night Call, Jalene Jordan.
Yes.
And Jalene will be doing the show solo next week as I take another undeserved vacation from the hardliest working man in show business. Just think of, never mind. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Call talkyes@yahoo.com is our emails. I'm going to read a few of those in a minute. I want to get back to a call we were talking to. Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And let's go back to Jeff in Fowlerville. Jeff said that he had read in his, what was the magazine, Jeff?
It was Legion Magazine from the Veterans of America, VA.
Yeah, when they were saying that the government of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, was aiding Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed group in Lebanon. So
right.
I don't know what backing means. They're certainly not sending them any money. I mean, at least I've never heard of that. Did the article say that?
It says he's supporting them. I don't recall if it says how he's supporting them. I wish I had the magazine in front of me to read it to you, but...
Actually, I know how he was supporting him. He was, he being Chavez, was, as many people were and many governments were, critical of Israel's invasion of Lebanon to attack Hezbollah. And, of course, you know, this was this military and political disaster for Israel. So he was, I don't know, I mean, if he was, I guess you could read if he was critical of Israel and they were fighting Hezbollah, that means he, quote, supports Hezbollah, but...
So just a play on words.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, people will judge you by your political support, but, I mean, that's sort of bizarre. Like, I was very critical of Israel's invasion, but I certainly don't support Hezbollah that, you know, it's this right-wing theocratic movement. And so, but I guess all things considered, we have our choice of buying gasoline from ExxonMobil to pay for the hundreds, I can't remember the figure, like over $100 million retirement package for their CEO, or we can buy Citgo and that it goes basically to the people of Venezuela. So I would think that even if people found Chavez objectionable, that still where the money winds up is ultimately more important to me.
Right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
That was good information, though, that we now know is being
spread. Yeah. Now, here, Rudolph Giuliani, there's an article about him in, let me see, where is, oh yeah, in Vanity Fair. It's called Crazy for Rudy, and it's an article by Michael Wolfe. He says, many New York political pros believe Rudy Giuliani, former mayor and now presidential candidate, is quite literally nuts.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he's a weird guy. The author asked whether Giuliani's lunatic behavior could be the ultimate campaign asset.
Well, is that because he did drag a couple of times? There's nothing wrong with that.
No, but he certainly did drag a number of times, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he enjoys
yeah.
it.
Yes, well, whatever.
Which I think is
yeah. not
beautiful.
That there's anything
whatever.
Wrong with that. Here, presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani, whose law firm represents an American subsidiary of a Hugo Chavez-controlled oil company, said Tuesday that the socialist Venezuelan president is dangerous to U.S. assets. Petróleos de Venezuela, the country's national oil company that Chavez controls, I mean, Chavez doesn't control it, but the Venezuelan government does, bought U.S.-based Citgo Petroleum Corporation in 1990. The Houston law firm, now known as Bracewell and Giuliani, has represented Citgo in matters involving the Texas legislature since 2005. So Giuliani is representing Citgo, and then
talking badly
yeah,
about them.
Right.
Okay. All
what
right.
did he do? He just found out that Chavez was a socialist?
Wake up,
I mean,
Rudy.
These people are. So he's threatening, he being Chavez, is threatening to nationalize banks. He says private banks have to give priority to financing the industrial sectors of Venezuela at low cost. If banks don't agree with this, they better turn over their banks, and that we will nationalize them and get all the banks that work for the development of the country and not to speculate and produce huge profits.
Wow.
Ooh, what an evil guy.
Pretty radical
oh,
there.
God, yeah. What a terrible man. Venezuela seizes last private oil fields. President Hugo Chavez's government took over Venezuela's last privately run fields on Tuesday. Now, this is what Giuliani was complaining about and saying this man's terrible. He's opposed to U.S. interests and all of that.
He's just playing to that base.
Yeah.
That's it.
The state takeover has been planned for some time. It includes BP, Conoco, is it Conoco or Conoco? Conoco, I think. ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil Corporation, Chevron Corporation, France's Total. You know, France owns Total. They call it Total, I think.
Ah.
And Norway's State Oil, ASA. So you would think they were really complaining, right? They're not.
No.
I mean, they're negotiating with the government over the terms and conditions under which they will be allowed to stay on as minority partners. Now, that's not what they wanted. I mean, they wanted to have this full control and to take all the profits out of Venezuela. But they're not complaining. Just Giuliani is. Right, let's go back to our phones here. Here's Peter in Detroit. Peter, it's Peter and Jolene. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Good. First time calling in, so I enjoy your show here. Very intelligent man here, and I just wanted to say thank you. It troubles me somewhat with the pre-war intelligence on Iraq.
Isn't that kind of an oxymoron now that we think of it?
Yeah. The pre-war unintelligence, non-intelligence. Yeah.
Obviously it was fabricated, and anybody with half a brain could have determined this from the beginning that we were getting a runaround here. But you mean to tell me that we have the best intelligence agency on the earth, and we didn't have an idea that a civil war was going to break out, or we were going to have all this problems of insurgency? It's almost like this is what is desired, and for whatever reason, I don't know, but what scares me is just how... so many of these facts are being covered up, even by, in the political system, whether it's right or left or whatever, facts like, Iran buying F-14 parts from us right now. And, we knew that Iraq had the chemical weapons and so forth, which we sold them back in the 80s. Nobody brings up these facts. It's always some just political crap that you're always hearing about. I just wonder what kind of...
Let me go back to the intelligence. There were... any number of findings and warnings that an insurgency could take place, that this could unleash a civil war. I mean, one of the reasons that George Bush Sr. did not, like he said, he did not want to occupy Iraq. He was afraid that the whole country would fracture, that a civil war would ensue. So, I mean, they knew this. They ignored it. It was all political considerations. It was all put together by, Powell and Wolfowitz and Pearl. And so they've just walked away from it, and they're just still these multimillionaires. Of course, Wolfowitz is involved in this scandal at the World Bank now, and they're trying to force him out. But, he'll land on his feet, and he'll be the director of some corporation.
Sure, yeah. They'll probably, all of them. I'm sure they'll be set for life. I just, it makes me wonder if there was maybe some kind of knee-jerk reaction. Maybe they did come across some intelligence, and, this is the, whatever plan it is for some other, other cause. I don't want to get off. I'm a big scientist. I do root everything in fact, and it's hard for me to really get into conspiracy theories. But when you really think about it, and everybody's talking, and now Tenet came out with his book saying, plans for the war in Iraq were there before 9/11, and Iran was always a big deal. And, we've been dinking around in Iran since the 50s,
sure.
Overthrowing democratically elected leaders. And, how's that for spreading freedom? What's our urge to get over there? Is it really oil? Maybe we hit Hubble's peak, and maybe they know something that they just can't tell everybody. It really kind of frightens me a little bit.
Well, I think it should frighten you. And a lot of it's out there. I mean, it takes some work. It shouldn't take any work. Every citizen should have all the information telling all the points of view, but we get essentially a corporatist point of view. The Democrats, which have moved a little on things, still aren't doing it adequately enough, in my estimation, but maybe they're working it slow. I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I don't mean Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, but like Henry Waxman and his the look into all this pre-war intelligence and corruption and the firing of these prosecutors for political reasons. Hopefully that's all going to I'm like the big sledgehammer. Impeach the MFs. That's IT MFA, right? Impeach the MFs already. You can go to ITMFA.com. right? And you can, or .org, can't remember which. I think it's .com. And maybe they're trying to do death of a thousand cuts because they deserve it, because there's not one thing that the Democrats are picking on that's, like, quote, political. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate that. I forgot I had all these emails that I wanted to release, a couple of them. Let's see here. Walt says, was this, as the Republican debate, the candidates were asked to raise their hands, pardon me, if they did not believe in evolution. Three of them did. Governor Mike Huckabee of Arkansas, Senator Sam Brownback of Arkansas, and Representative Tom Tancredo? That's not his name, is it? Maybe it is. Of Colorado. All three are considered second and third tier. Their answer forced John McCain to backtrack and talk about how he still believes that he can see God's hand in everything. Obviously, the religious right will play a big role in the Republican primary. My question is, do you think that the religious right will play a major role in the next election? Also, if the pro-choice Giuliani is nominated, do you think that he might split from the Republicans and form an anti-abortion third party in the next election? Huh? I don't really get that. But, I mean, it's... Yeah, I don't know.
I'm glad I missed that.
The debate, I missed it purposely.
I caught the end when they were doing their analysis, and it wasn't on purpose.
They are a pack of freaks.
I saw the picture the next morning in the paper of these, you know, the white bread suits all together, and I called you and I said, that is one scary group of men right there.
It is. What was I looking for? Something here. Oh, yeah, about, I can remember it. Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
They asked him what his favorite book was. Do you see that?
No, I don't.
And
think so.
Let me see. I can't remember. It's an L. Ron Hubbard book, the founder of
science. Yes.
What's the name of that? Something Earth.
Dianetics? Oh, Battlefield Earth?
Something like that. Okay. So he said that was his favorite book, and people started saying,
isn't that a Scientology book?
Yeah.
Right?
They said, sort of.
Loosely.
Hubbard was a science fiction writer as well.
Right. Makes it even weirder, in my opinion.
So then, of course, someone said, it's kind of an odd book for you to say is your favorite. And then he cleaned it up and he said, actually, my favorite book is the Bible.
Oh, yes.
Doesn't everybody realize what frauds these people are? I mean, it's just incredible. Now, we were talking earlier about the woman in South Dakota who had the vanity plate that said MPHW, and the state of South Dakota says, either she's got to bring the plates back or they're going to come and get them.
Yeah.
Paul writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I listen to your show every Sunday. Hey, my plate reads Blow Bill, B-L-O-B-I-L, like Blow Bill Clinton. I live in Michigan, and so we don't believe him, right? But he says, I own that plate. I will send a picture to prove it if you like.
Okay.
You just have to be creative so they don't catch on.
Send us a picture.
Yeah, I don't believe it.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it does. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF is our phones. Here's John, has been waiting patiently in St. Clair Shores, wants to talk about the gas problem. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great.
Hey, I listen to you guys every day on the way home from work. So just like I say, you guys are doing a great job.
Great.
Thank you.
One quick thing to go back. I heard you mention the industrial complex, the military industrial complex. Have you actually seen a movie? It's on cable, and it's called Why We Go to War.
Why We Fight.
Or Why We Fight. That's it. Yeah, that movie. Honestly, and I'll tell you this: as much as this is an unpopular opinion in the area, the first term I was a big Bush supporter. Second one, I was middle of the fence. I didn't vote on the second one on a second election.
Yeah.
But
No one else did either. Just 36% of the population.
That was a cancer or cancer or polio choice, Joan Baez.
Right, exactly. Yeah. There you go. But no, I mean, it's just that really opened up my eyes to a lot of things. But the real reason why I called was about the gas problems.
Sure.
And that's as much as we're talking about a boycott and everything like that. Although I think this is the fact that nobody really wants to recognize is that we've got to get off the oil tit, as you know, lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
The combustion engine has been obsolete for the last 20 years.
Well,
but yet but yet we still use it.
Yeah, I mean, because there's so much infrastructure and profit invested in. It's one of the keys to the world economy, particularly the industrialized country, to the point where we'll fight wars, we will destroy environmentally sensitive areas. And, I mean, oil is toxic, poisonous, destructive at every level when you start getting it out of the ground. When it's pumped, when it's shipped, when it's refined, and when it's burned. And then you have to go to war in order to secure its source. So we got to get off this damn stuff.
But I think what's happening here, I think that this is, as painful as this is, it's required, because otherwise it never would happen.
What's the it here?
It being the price gouging that's going on right now.
I mean, in other words, if it gets to a certain price, then people say, hey, maybe we should have electric cars.
Well, it's not even us. We're getting to the point to where the manufacturers of the automobiles now are getting to the point to where, because, I mean, if you notice, when they first came out with the hybrid, shortly thereafter, you saw a price drop in gas.
Huh.
I mean, and I'm not saying one is directly related to the other, but what I'm saying is that you're getting to the point where, why did they wait so long to do a hybrid? Well, because, you know, one hand is feeding the other. So, but now you're getting to the point where price gouging is so high, it's gonna force the automotive industry to change their technology. And, you know, I think, cause it's putting them out of business.
Well, I certainly think, well, isn't it General Motors is suffering in part because of low big vehicle sales? That's for sure. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for having joined us.
Gas is $2 a gallon in Dubai.
Is it?
I learned that this past week, yes.
Yeah, but the people are getting ripped off. As I said, in Caracas, it's 14 cents a gallon.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, though, I mean, on one hand, because since we consume it and we're drivers and all of that, but the whole city is just so polluted. It's in this kind of valley right by the coast, Caracas is. And man, I mean, you wish, you kind of wish it was $5 a gallon so people wouldn't drive so much. They have a wonderful subway system that I think is like 14 cents. Is everything 14 cents there?
Maybe.
Yeah, and it's as modern, you know, the city, as I've said, when I was there, I found it, there's a little litany I always say, crowded, noisy, polluted, and dangerous. And yet you go down into the subway, and it's very cool. I mean,
you weren't fearful.
No, modern. Somebody I was with got their pocket picked.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And
you have a lot in there?
Well, you know, I mean, when you're in countries like that, and you have your passport and all your money and all your credit cards like in your back pocket, hello.
Yeah. Probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, wasn't a good idea. Okay, back
lessons
to...
Lessons learned.
Lessons learned the very hard way. Yeah. Let's see. Here is Ron. Ron's in Detroit. Hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, okay. The volume dropped down.
Oh.
Yeah. Listen, I'd like to address the issue you made when you said that, you know, it's all our tax dollars paying for the war.
Right.
No, it's worse than that. Actually, the main problem with the United States and everything that's happening here is because we are allowing our government to pursue empire. And ever since Nixon, it is not true that it is just us paying for those the war. The fact is, the United States, as an empire, has rigged up an economic system which forces all of its trading partners who run a surplus with us, and that includes China, to subsidize us. Once you understand that, you'll understand just how bad it is and why the world is attempting to rebel against the dollar. Now, I can only recommend that you read Super Imperialism, The Origin and Fundamentals of U.S. World Dominance by economist Michael Hudson. In fact, there's a copy of his pre-publication copy available on the Internet for free.
Huh.
All you have to do is put Michael Hudson and .pdf, you know, the extension for the file extension, and Super Imperialism. Up it will come. It'll be right on the first page of your Google search or whatever.
Well, Ron, also, there's a book somebody I interviewed, and I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Was it Peter Romano? It sounds, but it's called The Coming China Wars.
Well, I want to tell you something. I listened to your interview with Navarro.
Navarro, yes.
And I was extremely disappointed. He basically is a waste of time. He talked about a lot of bad issues. He's trying to turn, I really think he's part of the elite system trying to create these trade wars and turn China into the bad guy. Look, China does its own self-interest, so does the United States. The two countries use each other. But I have news for you. It is the United States that is the problem in this relationship, not China. China is simply doing what it has to do. But you have to understand that when foreign countries sell us stuff, more stuff than they buy from us, they end up with dollars.
Right.
The dollar is worthless.
Well, they're forced to keep its value up.
Well, what they have to do, Peter, is because most of that money goes through the central bank system, they have no choice. I mean, you and other people say, well, they buy our treasury notes. They wouldn't buy our treasury notes unless they had to, because they know they're worthless. They're forced to buy it because when the money comes through the central bank system, the central banks can't do anything else but that. They cannot do direct investment. Now, the Chinese can do some direct investment, but we just tell them, no,
they are pardon me, they're starting to move towards direct investment.
But they cannot do much of that because the United States simply warns them, we will not allow that. Congress steps in. We will not allow you to buy that. So,
and that's what Navarro is advocating, not allowing them. You're right. It's a very, I was saying before about 20th century. That's very 20th century. That is trade wars, and that's not going to get us anywhere.
The real problem is that it's up to the United States, the people of this country, to end empire. That's why all of the candidates, including all the Democratic candidates, and I'm sorry to say even Kucinich and even Gravel, you know there's something wrong with their approach when they fail to point out, folks, we have to stop the empire. We have to live like a normal country. We have to stop forcing other countries to subsidize us, which is what we're doing with the dollar, and we're going to have to obviously fold our huge military. It's got to stop, Peter.
Well, you're right. And if anyone's listening to you and saying, wait a minute, you know, the road we're on now is the road to disaster. And the empire has been the road to disaster for every country that has ever went way beyond its geography, whether you can start with Rome and go all the way through the Dutch and the French and the English, where they're eventually their empire bankrupted.
But Peter, as Hudson points out, never before has an empire arranged for an economic Ponzi scheme arrangement that the United States has been able to impose. And that happened with Nixon. It's a joke that when you think Nixon, you think of the Vietnam War, you think of Watergate. But in fact, Nixon's biggest criminal legacy is an economic system that most people don't even understand. And Hudson makes that perfectly clear. Nixon is the guy who came up with this scheme, and every president since then has been quite happy to continue with what he describes as an ongoing criminal enterprise.
Well, I'll tell you, Michael Hudson, I'm going to check him out. The other thing is that every single candidate, I thought, is McCain crazy? He's actually asking for an expansion of the military, expenditures. And Giuliani is as well. And there's Barack Obama, same thing.
And Hillary wants to spend
more. Yeah.
And even Edwards wants to spend more. And I'll tell you why. Because they literally want to conquer the world, and they're hoping they can do so before our economy completely collapses. This is why they're gutting our economy. This is what an empire does. It has to take all the wealth out of its own little starting location in order to push it into what it wants to create, a new, you know, this entire empire.
Well, it's a prescription for collapse, to be sure. All right, listen, thanks for the tip. Michael Hudson, I think all we got to do is probably Google him, and we'll get it. Thanks for calling in with that. And those are the kind of things I'm sure that a lot of people are probably scratching their heads. On the face of it, that makes any sense. But does it? Yeah, empire is the road to disaster, and it has been historically. And it depends on where you are in things. Are you at the ascendancy of the empire, or are you at the end of it? And if you're at the end of it, it gets pretty ugly. You know what, Jillian, we never mentioned was our MySpace site tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. And you can be our friend.
We have a lot of friends. We do.
We're getting more and more friends.
I need to get in there and do a little work on that.
You have not figured out how to answer the email?
No. I'm having problems. I had a very busy week last week, so I didn't really have
Should we ask time. People to email you? No?
If they'd like, they can, sure. I can't answer them.
Oh, at the site. Yeah, all right.
I could answer from a different email, though.
Yeah. Here's Jim in Lincoln Park. Jim, it's Peter and Jolene at 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead. I did it again. How do I keep screwing up like this? I'm sorry, Jim.
It's one of those
Go ahead. You're there.
Okay, I agree with the gas, you know, the way it is, with them not buying, but I think it makes more sense not to burn any of that that day, because you'd just be buying more before and more after.
You know,
like
Jim,
last year I was in protest of the gas being so high. I normally go up north. I got a place in Sheboygan. I didn't burn not 1 ounce of gas Memorial Day holiday. If more people would do that, like for 3 days, wouldn't be so selfish as to go, well, I'm working, I earned this vacation. If they just stay home one big holiday and not burn any gas. I didn't burn not 1 ounce, not even my lawnmower.
You know, that's very interesting,
yeah.
Because that seemed to be the one flaw in it, that you'd have to fill up the day before.
Eventually,
or the day after.
Yeah.
And they'd go, okay, have your fun, guys, but then you know, you're eventually going to have to make it up.
We know you'll be back.
If there was a use boycott as well, that would do it. Good idea. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for that.
And Steve, good for you for staying home.
Al Slayer, who will be on the air doing the Riff Rock and Roll at 2 a.m. after our interviews, including the one with Patti Smith, writes, Steve from Macomb, in our little, what do you call this, our little note message.
Yeah, message board back and
yeah.
forth, yeah.
Well, just parenthetically, let me say, for a little while, it was very hot in here. Now it's getting very cold again,
isn't
it? Yeah. Steve from Macomb called, Al tells us, and the retired ExxonMobil executive is Lee Raymond. That's right. His retirement package was around $400 million.
Okay. Well, we were light, and I was light on my estimate.
I'd rather err on that side.
Sure.
Let's see here. Here's Steve in Grosse Pointe. Steve, hi. You're on the air. Steve.
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, so are we.
Yeah, we are too. What's up?
Yeah, I know. I just had a side note about one of the last previous calls.
What's that?
I challenge anybody to research the Federal Reserve. It is actually privately owned by World Banks.
Yeah, well, that's the way it works. Worked like that for, I don't know, 100 years or so.
Yeah, but shouldn't we be printing our own money?
Printing our own money?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like,
well,
I think it's counterfeiting?
No, this money that is fiat that doesn't have, it's just a promissory note. It doesn't have,
right.
It's not backed by anything.
Well, it's backed by, I forgot what it says, but you know, like the goodwill and trust in the government. So, I mean, money is kind of weird if you think about it. No economists are quite sure how it represents value or even really how value is attained in many ways, and the idea that that it has to be backed by precious metal, and how does precious metal get value to begin with, is another question. But there's not enough precious metal in the world to back the currency that's needed for international commerce. So it is just this stuff. In fact, it's not even, you know, it used to be like paper dollars, and on it would say, you know, I forgot what it's, Federal Reserve note, and it was sort of a promissory note. And now, though, it's all just sort of cyber dollars. Like, I don't know how much money you have in the bank. I don't have any money in the bank. I have something that is a numerical representation that in a lot of sense isn't even real money, right? Are you with me? What did I just do?
Hello?
Oh,
there
hi.
You are.
You know what? I did something very weird. I blew him off and put you on the air. It's Christian from Bloomfield. So,
hi.
Hi. I, you know what? wait a minute. I hit the keyboard. Jolene, don't when you do the show alone next week, don't do any of what I've done tonight.
Okay.
Christian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just called to say hello and thank you very much for your show, and hello to both of you. I was just wanted to pose a question and take your answer off the air. I was wondering what we could do locally, since the topic tonight has basically been gas and energy and emissions and such, what we can do to affect the Woodward Cruise.
The Woodward Dream Cruise, which I should tell people listening around the country and around the world, is this event in August where thousands of cars, primarily from the 40s and 50s and 60s, but you know, on other sides of that as well, classic cars come and drive up and down Woodward, up and down, up and down. And it used to be on a Saturday. Now it begins like, it's almost like a week.
Tuesday or Wednesday, yeah.
And so you got these great old restored cars, but it uses like this extraordinary amount of gasoline. A million people often line our main drag of Woodward Avenue to see, and it's a great festive occasion. It's another, people love it.
People love it. So, but what do you do? Maybe you just do more of the parking in the parking lots, and people could admire you from there.
Or perhaps, you know, you move it to a different location, and it becomes more of a spectacle where everyone gets to walk around the cars and not necessarily get caught in gridlock and
right. I think that's
hard for
Jillian
everyone
meant,
to
right?
get around.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I know that there's at the state fairgrounds at 8 Mile Road and Woodward Avenue, they always have the cars on display. And people, because I'll tell you, I usually walk up there, ride up there or something, and after a while, it's just I think, geez, it's like watching traffic. Because after a while, about a third of the cars are classic cars, or cruisers, as they call it, and then the rest of them are
people
just,
like you and I.
Just driving up and down Woodward, you know. So
stereo show-offs.
Yeah, yeah. All right, thank you very much, and my apologies to the caller that I accidentally blew off was bringing up the Federal Reserve System.
Right.
And that's not a problem. I mean, it's the way that the money is regulated. I'm not sure exactly what people would think would be in place of that. I mean, there's problems. Sure, this is the way the elites manage the economy. I mean, there's no doubt about that, through the Federal Reserve System. It's owned by this conglomeration of banks, and they, you know, deal with the setting interest rates and all that. All right, we'll be right back. Peter Werbe, Jillian Jordan, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Really do pray, come and
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. Remember, May 19th, and you've got a really, Jalene, you know, I know you're too modest for show business.
I know, it's bad. Yeah. It's really bad.
May 19th, Saturday, May 19th.
I'll never go anywhere.
We'll all assemble at the New Way Bar on Woodward, just north of 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. We didn't even say where it was. Jalene and her band is going to be playing, including friend of mine, Dirk, who's going to be playing bass.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is fabulous. I just hooked up with him, and so this is going to be fun. We're going to do some, do my originals. We're going to do Tom Jones tunes.
Right.
Do some Rolling Stones. We're going to get
guys crazy. Throw their underpants at you.
Well, I wondered about that. I'm hoping that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I know. Because women used to throw their underpants at Tom Jones.
They still do.
They still do.
Yeah.
But there's something. Yeah,
a little bit. You know, if it's brand new,
yeah,
and you haven't worn it, then
I was gonna,
throw
no,
it.
No, this joke. I was going to say a joke, but this is in such a bad taste.
Okay.
Never mind. Oh, yeah.
We'll keep it clean.
Doug, it's not even. It's just in bad taste.
Okay. Yeah. I trust you, Peter.
Yeah. All right. Doug writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Love your show. Trust me, if there was a boycott on gasoline and 50% of the people boycotted for one day, this may not have an immediate impact, but believe me, this would make the government stand up and notice. Solidarity among the subjected class is absent. I like that phraseology, the subjected class. At least till this possible united action. Please support the boycott. If people can become conscious of their own solidarity, now know what we can do. Yeah, absolutely. Remember we used to play that United Steelworkers song, Solidarity Rocks?
Yes, I do. It's been a few years.
I liked it. Paul writes in, Paul was DetroitLiberation.org, and Saturday, we didn't go to that. They had the marijuana, the Cinco de Marijuana.
Yeah. Now, was that in the evening?
No, well, it was at noon, and then at 4:20.
Right, yeah.
Because that's the
I wanted to go. I work late and sleep on Saturdays. Saturdays are tough for me.
Yeah.
I hope it went well. Did it go well?
I don't know. Paul, you'll have to call us. Call us and let us know. He's going to have a vanity plate that's 6-UL-DV-8.
Oh, sexual
deviate. Yeah, read it fast.
Deviate.
Sexual deviate.
Okay.
People's minds are always working, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Let's see. Hey, you guys are great. Listen to you every Sunday while working at a 7-Eleven gas station. You're a petroleum transfer agent. Right?
Oh.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to comment about the gas strike on May 15th. I have heard a lot about this. I think it will not work, really, because my boss already told us that it is not going to work. Well,
don't always believe the boss.
He will not lower his price, and neither will the guy across the street. Unless this strike is around the country and is for about 3 days, it will never work. Well, okay. There you go. Let's do it. That's what I would say.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
go ahead.
It's better to try than not at all, I guess, right?
Here's Paul in Brighton. Paul, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you guys?
We're great.
Great.
Now, you know, I always ride my bike.
There you go.
And I've even talked to you about it before. And we won't go there again because it's like if there's a possibility at any time where you can find yourself, you're just sitting at home, ride your bike.
It's a little tough in the winter. I see people doing it.
Now's the time to break that out, though. You know what? You just reminded me. I need to get some air in my tires. Yeah.
I've been doing this a long time. And, you know, it's not just that either. And they talk about, I've heard a few people actually start to laugh and make a funny joke about global warming. I even said this a long time ago. If any time our atmosphere gets warmer, the ice peaks, then the glaciers that we have in our own little area like Arizona and those places where you see that's the
Montana,
fresh water.
Yeah.
That's the fresh water that runs down.
Yeah.
Those little streams that make up those great big waterfalls, if that ceases to apprehend to stop trickling, there goes our fresh water, folks. And it's ain't a joke.
Well, I know. Thank you so much. This never happened to me when I used to do this show by myself.
But you're right about that.
You are. Sorry, we're not laughing at you, Paul.
It's not you.
Remember when we were doing that nationally syndicated show, there used to be this guy that would start talking and just start talking this bizarre, surreal...
Which one?
There you go. Sorry. Well, boy, I'm glad we pulled out of that. I almost lost it here.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not even sure what struck us so funny, because what you were saying. Yeah, ride your bike. I'm getting my bike back together. Bicycle.
Yes.
Here's Jack in Sterling Heights. Jack, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing there, Peter Werby?
We're doing great.
Oh, it's good to hear you laugh. You ought to do that more.
I'm good for his health.
Yes. Yeah, I read somewhere that belly laughs. My wife always says all I do is chuckle. So laughs like that are probably good.
Yeah, and those big laughs only happen a couple times a year, and I had one last night. It was fabulous.
What's up, Jack?
Well, laughing is contagious.
Yeah,
well,
it
good.
Is.
And I'd like to talk about the national whatever 15th of May. That is about the dumbest idea.
Oh, no.
You can try whatever you want. I'm not going to waste my time. But I'll tell you an idea that'll work, and I'll make it real quick.
Wait. Before you do, though, tell us why you don't think it'll work or why it's dumb.
Because the oil companies have too many options. They can jack the price up, make up their losses. There's a million things they can do to you. They can make it really rough on you if they want to.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. They could be, in a sense, respond like Walmart did to unionization. Like when people unionized their Montreal store, they close the store. I mean, that's the kind of hardball power that they have economically. But I think somebody, in fact, it was the email, that it's beginning to experience solidarity. They depend on us being atomized, fragmented, these little, just the fragments of humanity that have no power because they're this huge force. They control everything. And the only power that people ever have is when we get together. And we get together, we can have a revolution in 1776. We can end slavery. We can form unions. We can do anything. But we can't do it all by ourselves. So I would say this, Jack. If it turns out to be a bust, then it's back to the drawing boards. And we say, okay, at least we had the capacity to get together, to do something to, what did the guy say, the subject class or the subjected class began to raise its head, and it maybe was beginning. Okay, but go ahead. What's your alternative?
Well, let's put our drawing boards away permanently. I'm going to tell you a solution. Let's head for it right now. Let's quit wasting our time marching. We did all that in the Vietnam days, and what do we have? Nothing. We got another war called Iraq. It didn't work. Here's the idea real quick.
Go ahead.
You got to have D-Day, the deposing of your politicians, the same way we vote them in. You got to get them out of office by popular vote. I know you're going to find fault. There is no fault. I've already researched this.
But you'll find it.
You'll find it, Peter. I know. You have a right to. That's you have a right to be skeptical. But these politicians know you can't get rid of them. And once they're in office, you watch now, all these elections coming up, they're going to tell you what you want to hear. And they're never going to provide it for you. We've been hearing about medical care, family values for 18 years now. You never get it. They're all one and the same. They're corrupt. You got to have the opportunity, if you vote them in and they're not doing their job. The only trick to this is you got to get these people to vote that law into effect, and they're not going to do it because they know if they do, their days of corruption in D.C. are over.
Well, they have something called the impeachment process in the Constitution, and almost there's an ability to recall any sitting politicians. So, there are millions of people. You can just, if people want to take a look at that, or if you have or have not, Jack, you can just go put Google, if you have the computer, and put in impeach Bush, and you'll probably have about 200,000 sites, because it's percolating up from the bottom. Yeah, recall them all, I'd say. Thank you, Jack, who says no to the gas boycott. He said not so much that he opposes it, but he says it's not going to be effective. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF. It's Al in Royal Oak. Al, hi. You're on the air.
Jeez. Hello.
Oh, yeah, hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
I have like an alternative thing that I think would work better than the May 15th boycott. I mean, I'm not opposed to that. You know, it could be a good thing, but
yeah.
My plan would be to boycott the highest priced company, which I don't know, maybe it's Exxon now. I'm not sure.
Well, all the prices are pretty much within a range.
Well, whoever it is, boycott them first, and not everybody's going to do it, but it would hurt them, and then they would lower their prices. And when their prices go lower than the next one, and you boycott the other one, and so on and so forth, and keep doing it that way. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. I get the logic.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's another.
Well, yeah, buy from Citgo.
There you go. Yeah, $2.99.
We'll
whoa,
make it easy
what a bargain
for you. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. And here, this is evidence of what I was saying. People are beginning to think about this. How can we resist? And that's what we need. We need a culture of resistance. We do not need what we have now, which is a culture of submission. All right, here is Adam in Detroit. Adam, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hey, Peter. This is Adam Brooke, organizer of the Hash Bash.
Hey, Adam, how you doing?
Good, good. I'm also out working with John Sinclair a little bit. So
John Sinclair, we should tell him, man, we can't take anything granted. John Sinclair, the first manager of the MC5 rock band, also founder of the White Panther Party, and author, and musician, and poet. And he's in our town.
Yes, he's in town this week promoting his re-release of the book Guitar Army, which John and I also opened the Liberation Day pot rally down at Grand Circus Park on Saturday.
How'd that go?
That was wonderful. We were there only at the very beginning because John had to go do an interview for a Grandy Ballroom documentary that he's participating in.
Nice.
Oh, that's great.
It was about five different hits that day for him. But
now he's
was
performing tomorrow night, right? Tonight?
Yeah, tomorrow he's at the Buzz Bar down on Larned and at Rockabilly's out in Sterling Heights. He's doing an in-store. And, you know, if people are interested in protest, Guitar Army, the book, was what turned me on to protest. And that's kind of how I got involved in, you know, things like the Hash Bash. But... You know, I actually turned on just as you guys were talking about the protests of gasoline, and you know,
Let me keep you on. I want to one thing. We're now into Monday, so you're talking. When is John appearing? Is it on
John
Monday?
Is 5 p.m. at Rockabilly's.
Monday. Right. Okay. Now, are you taking him around, Adam, as you often do?
Yes.
Where are you going to be at 3 p.m. today?
Today at 3 p.m., according to my schedule, I have an interview at WRIF with Peter Werby.
There you go. Good. That's what I wanted
just
to hear.
Making sure.
I just wanted to hear that.
Yes, I am well aware.
All right. Okay. Good. So I just wanted to be sure.
You know, working with John, it's really all about protest and... you know, this gasoline protest thing, I'm afraid that we're talking huge powers here, and I think they can weather these type of storms. I've seen corporations weather storms like this no problem. They seem to be able to pull out, you know, Goodyear was able to pull out with their tire disaster. All kinds of cars have been recalled, and these car companies can withstand that. But I have noticed one thing that gets the establishment and certainly the media to take notice of any protest, and the establishment in places like Ann Arbor have actually rid themselves of some protests that they didn't like.
What's that?
Nudity. If you involve nudity, like they did the Naked Mile, for instance, they ran that out of Ann Arbor.
They did.
They basically convinced all these students that they were being exploited and put all over the Internet, and then because they ran naked through the street on the final day of school, their life would be ruined. Of course, they also said that there were people that would grab at them and assault them, so that, you know, they fear-mongering.
Remember, Adam, and I just thought of this, in the run-up to the Iraq War, there were protests all over the world where women took off their clothes and formed the words with their bodies, no war. Remember that, Jolene? We interviewed some
that.
Of the people.
I was invited to join into a few of those, but I just never made it.
Well, and there, in Australia, there was one, they had like 4,000 women in it or something like that, or one thing, I don't know. I hate to exaggerate.
About peace and things like that.
Yeah, and what they're spelling out now, but they're doing it dressed, is impeach.
Oh, okay.
That's in fact. Let me see. Is that yeah? If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and go to A28, it says, which was the impeach day, April 28th. It'll show you all these scenes all over the country, and also what's called freeway blogging, where people put signs up on the freeway. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah, that's catching on, isn't it?
Are you ready to bear all, Adam?
Well, yeah. I mean, hell, I've always been willing to take my clothes off. I'm not suggesting
all right.
that.
I don't want you to do this today at WRIF, though.
No. I'm certainly not. And I'll be real honest. When I'm just talking nudity, in the United States, the one nudity that they seem to take exception to is the female form.
I don't know. I think they'd get a little more upset if they saw the male form these days. I know what you're saying. You know, I mean, but. All right. Listen, I got to get on to some other calls, so I'll see you later in the day.
We'll see you later.
All right. I'm looking forward to interviewing John Sinclair. We'll air that next week for certain. Okay. Here is Mike. Mike's in Westland. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, Peter.
Hi, Mike.
How you doing? I've talked to you. I'm a longtime listener, and I just wanted to say just a couple little things on the don't buy gas thing.
Yeah.
I think it's an excellent idea, and I think in theory it's probably going to work. The only thing about it that a lot of people don't take into consideration is municipalities, police departments, fire departments, they don't have the option of not purchasing gas, and they purchase a lot of fuel.
Right.
A lot less than your average consumers do, but they can't, and a lot of those people are back in that theory too, and they can't do it because of the fact that they got to be trying to protect and serve their people too. And I just think that, you know, there's got to be a give and take. And the thing with diesel fuel that gets me is the price of diesel fuel. It doesn't take as much refining to produce diesel fuel as it does gasoline.
All right.
And they're just really ripping off people who use diesel fuel. They're making the profit on diesel fuel is a lot greater than it is on gasoline. So if the price of crude doesn't go up, they're just ripping us off. Is that's the general consensus,
sure.
Correct?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Yep. And then the earlier caller that said that about the gentleman he's seen with the vet leather jacket about burning the flag.
Yeah, it says burn this flag, a-hole. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think when people see that and they see the profanity in that or whatnot, I think that what they don't realize is a lot of veterans, you know, were serving their country, whether it was a popular war or not or whatever it was, and they see people that served with them being killed, and they're attributing that they're dying for the flag. And that's why a lot of people feel so strongly about it, but I just think that a lot of people see that, and I think they kind of miss the point on that.
Well, I think so, but it's really not an issue, and I'm surprised that people still haul it out, I guess.
For some people, I guess it still is. And, you know, I saw my first flag burned.
You saw a flag burn?
I did in D.C. at the counter inaugural.
Oh.
Two years ago.
Oh, that's
yeah. Nice. Well, the sad thing was the guy couldn't get the flag to burn. Well, he was burning his pants. And we're all yelling, dude, your pants are on fire. And he thought that we were into it, going, yeah, go, go, go. But we weren't. He just burned himself. So he was trying, though.
Did he wrap himself in the flag to put it on?
You know, I didn't stick around because the pepper spray came out. I had to go.
Uh-oh. Not a major problem, that's for sure. Thank you, Mike. Here's Steve in Shelby Township. Hi, Mike. Wait a minute. What are we doing here? What am I?
Well, Peter, I love the show. I listen to you all the time. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for joining us. I have never... Jolene Jordan is going to be doing the show next week.
I
was showing her during one of the breaks how to operate this phone system. I have made more mistakes tonight than I probably have since we inaugurated this system. Here's Steve in Shelby Township. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, we're just near the end of the show, so tell me what's up.
Oh, nothing. You know, I've just been listening for the past couple of minutes. I heard a guy, Jack, he was saying it was completely stupid to boycott gasoline, and I'm not going to go so far as to say it's stupid because I appreciate anybody who's motivated to do anything, but I just see this as, first of all, I see it as supply and demand. If this happened almost a year ago, everyone was talking the same thing, then oil prices dipped back down almost to $1.50 a gallon, and I didn't hear anyone complaining when they dipped down saying raise the oil prices back up. You know, it's only when it's high. So why don't we, instead of trying to boycott something, why don't we make something of it, buy some oil stock,
buy some Chevron, buy some Exxon, and when they report, you guys will see some money instead of getting around and trying to boycott this. Why don't you guys get involved in that way?
And then we can,
dirty money.
We can,
I don't
we can
want anything to do with it.
All right. Thank you very much. Here's Dean and Taylor. Go ahead, Dean. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I just wanted to call to let you know that I'm proudly participating in the protest on May 15th, but it's the protest of stupid ideas and not the gas out. So I'll be filling up pretty much everything I have with gas because, I mean, it's really just a pretty stupid idea on almost every level. I don't really see how people think it's going to make any difference whatsoever.
Well, why would you want to try to sabotage it?
Well, because it's a dumb idea. I mean, I like ideas that are grounded in logic and that make some, you know, some semblance of sense. And if people don't gas up on May 15th, they're going to gas up on May 14th or May 16th.
Right. So well, that's what we were talking about. See, I mean, one of the things, rather than being...
But don't gas up everything. Yeah. You don't have to go crazy.
One of the things, rather than being as, you know, cynical like that, why not say, okay, or wait and see, all right, is this going to work? And then it happens, and you're saying it won't work at all. So then it's going to be self-evident whether it works or not. Okay, it didn't work. What next? I mean, that is really the question that would we'd have to ask. Or, I mean, I can't believe that one day is going to solve all our problems. But the idea, as I said earlier, that people move from a culture of submission to a culture of resistance, I think is extraordinarily important. All right, thank you very much. We've got to end this part of the show, so appreciate your call. Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Let's just run through it one more time. I will not be here next week. Jalene Jordan will be hosting.
And next week, John Sinclair's interview will be airing.
Yeah, that will definitely run. And also, Jalene, for those of you in the Detroit area, will be performing Saturday, May 19th at the New Way Bar, which is on Woodward at about 9.5 Mile Road in fabulous Ferndale.
Thanks, Peter.
So I hopefully will be back.
I hope you will be.
I'll be back.
I know you will be.
Stay tuned for Patti Smith, the just inducted inductee of the 2007 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Awards. And we're going to be playing some of her music from her brand new album
Very
as
nice.
Well.
Looking forward to it.
This is WRIM.com.
I know.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, and a great pleasure to introduce to our airways the 2007 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, Patti Smith. Patti Smith, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, thanks. Hi.
And you got a brand new album called 12, and it's 12 what they call cover songs. And I got a little nervous at first. Wow, these songs, they're so identified with other people. But you did a bang-up job. Did you have any trepidation about recording these, since they're so identified with these greats like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and so many other greats, Jimi Hendrix? How did you feel about doing those?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I felt ready to do all them. The only one that sort of intimidated me was White Rabbit, because Grace Slick has done like the quintessential vocal on that. But I didn't do White Rabbit to equal or better Grace Slick. I did it to actually pay homage to her, because she was such an important influence on me, and so important to the evolution of the rock and roll vocal. So that was my salute to Grace.
Now, your last album was in 2004, Trampin', and so that's been 3 years, and you've spent a lot of time on this. Why not more Patti Smith material? Why did you want to do these covers?
Well, I mean, I have a lot of, I will be doing my own record soon. It's just, I just always wanted to do it, and it was part of the structure of my Columbia contract, and it was really something I've always wanted to do but never felt really qualified as a singer to tackle that many that range of songs. And I also I've been traveling a lot in the last couple of years, gathering information and meeting new musicians and widening my perspective, and so I just did these songs really to speak, a lot of the songs to speak for me. You know, there's a range of songs that tackle spiritual issues and political issues, and some I like, Midnight Rider, that I just like personally. So it was really, I've been doing it, off and on for over a year, just as a little salute to the lyricist. All of these songs and the treatment of each song are lyric-oriented. They're very, some of them are very stripped down, but that's so people could really hear the lyrics to these really great songs.
Patti Smith is my guest. She has a brand-new Columbia album out called 12, and they're 12. I don't even like to call them cover, because they have that unique flavor. I mean, I got a little nervous. I was thinking, can she do it? But just like Gloria now belongs to Patti Smith, I don't know. I don't know if we're going to get to the point where these also are more identified with you, or at least equally.
Well, it was a different, Gloria evolved over a three-year period. And, I didn't just go in the studio and do Gloria. It evolved as a live piece. But these days it's harder to quietly evolve everything, because people just tape you and put it out. So I just decided I was just going to go in the studio with songs, and we talk about them and just do them. We didn't do it quick or anything. We did it through the year, but it would be, I'd contemplate a song and we'd just go spend a day or two. And a lot of the songs are essentially live, but with a lot of contemplation, but they weren't, they didn't evolve over a 2 to 3 year period like Gloria did.
Mm-hmm. And the We that you mentioned is more expansive than just your band. Tell us about some of the people that played on this and the role that they played in your new CD.
Well, the core band, of course, is my drummer, J.D. Doherty, Tony Shanahan on bass, and Lenny Kay. And we just, in my travels, I met new people. I met Flea in London during the meltdown, and he's become such a good friend. And he stopped in, and we did Gimme Shelter and White Rabbit with Flea, and also Tom Verlaine. So, and Tom Verlaine is our good friend. So on two of the cuts, like Boy in the Bubble, Rich Robinson plays Dobro on that. And I literally met Rich Robinson in a, having coffee in a cafe. I didn't know who he was or anything. He just introduced himself as a friend of my tour manager, and he turned out to be a musician. I just asked him to come by and play that night, and he did. And Louis Resto, who the great Detroit musician, Louis Resto, who also works with Eminem, and his brother Mario, we all got together in Detroit on Martin Luther King's birthday and did Pastime Paradise. So, I mean, all the people, including my son and daughter, who play on the record are our friends. And they really add another dimension, but it's an organic dimension. On Teen Spirit, my friend from 1970, Sam Shepard, played banjo with his son, 17-year-old son Walker. So it's really a mix of, you know, my core band and good friends.
Well, Patti Smith, you've been doing rock and roll music for 40 years, and so your career and your life is intersected with so many of the people that whose songs that you do here: Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, The Doors, Jefferson Airplane, The Beatles, The Rolling Stones, Paul Simon. Did any of them know beforehand, or have they subsequently commented on your versions?
No, I mean, you know, I feel like I've walked with these people so much of my life that they nearly feel like friends. You know, I mean, I know Bob Dylan somewhat, Neil Young, but I met the Allman Brothers in 1970, but I don't really know these people. I just, ironically, the only person I've heard from through the grapevine was the fella that wrote the Tears for Fears song. He loved the version. He's the only person I heard from. But you know, I mean, I just I did these songs really just to really salute the people and their lyrics, and also it was a real learning experience mm-hmm. for me.
Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears. Why don't we play one of the cuts, the Rolling Stones song, Gimme Shelter. This is Patti Smith from a brand new CD, 12. That was Patti Smith, brand new from her 12 CD, just released, and it's a collection of songs by other people. You mentioned in the liner notes, with very attractive packaging, by the way, that's an anti-war song. And I know you're very active in political causes and very concerned about our world. It's odd. I never thought of that as an anti-war song.
Well, the thing is, that's why I another reason why I loved working on this record. I learned a lot about the intentions and motivations of these songwriters in singing the song. I've danced to that song 1,000 times and never really considered the lyrics. But, you know, Mick Jagger is saying, war, children, it's just a shot away.
Right.
And love is just a kiss away. He's giving us these two alternatives and really almost begging people to consider, you know, what the canopy of our world's going to be, that the shelter of our world, is it going to be, you know, love or war? And a lot of these songs offer these two alternatives, whether it's Within You, Without You, Pastime Paradise. They offer these two states of mind. And, you know, so that this record wasn't just fun to do, but it was instructive. And, you know, I wasn't my intention to embellish or take the songs to some, level like Gloria. And also, these days, you really can't. Artists often refuse licenses to you if you inject your own poetry into the song. So I had to be very careful in not invading the artists, you know.
Sure.
Space or intentions, and I tried to remain fairly faithful to what the artist had in mind.
We last spoke, now all of a sudden a long time ago, 1999 at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, this fancy hotel, Peter Werby and Patti Smith in the Waldorf. It's an amazing setting. But you were close to being depressed about the state of the world then, I remember. I remember you not getting much of a smile out of you as we talked. And how about Patti Smith today as you look at the world?
Well, I mean, I think the world is in a worse place than it was in 1999. I mean, I was very concerned about just the materialism and corporatization of our world, and it's getting worse and worse. And, of course, going into Iraq was, for me, a heartbreaking and immoral decision. But even with all the difficult and obviously bad things in our world, whether it's environmental or corporate, I have a lot of faith in the New Guard. I think the New Guard is doing a lot of interesting things musically, and they're really starting to possess a whole technological space and possibilities of communication that we didn't have. And I think once they concentrate and decide what issues they want to tackle, whether it's environmental issues or the upcoming election, they're going to be very strong. So I have a lot of faith in them, and you know, I'm always going to be optimistic. I'm always going to willing to believe in the future.
While maybe even give you a chance to get the call or whatever. Well, let's play another cut from the brand new CD.
They're trying to get me to come downstairs, but let's finish up.
Okay. Well, let's do this one real quickly, and we'll come back and say goodbye. This is from Patti Smith's new CD, 12. This is Neil Young's Helpless.
Yeah. Swirling shadows on our eyes leave us helpless, helpless, helpless. Helpless, helpless, helpless. Helpless, helpless, helpless. Helpless, helpless, helpless.
That was from Patti Smith's brand new CD. It's called 12, a collection of songs by other people. A wonderful version there of Neil Young's Helpless. And I didn't mean that as a comment on what we were just talking about, because we're not helpless, are we?
No, I think that we have, you know, individually and collectively, I still believe that we have as much power as we want to take on. And I love doing that little song, Helpless, though. Actually, in its own way, it was illustrative of that, because we were having a difficult time in the studio, a little frustrated, and it was the end of the night. And I just looked it around at my people, and, you know, I just thought I didn't want to end our night so poorly. And I just said, well, let's just do a song that we know. And I asked our road manager and our tech fella, Barry Dorier, to play bass so that we would have real solidarity of crew and band. And we did this song quietly at the end of the night. And in doing this song, it reunified us. It restored our sense of community and made us feel optimistic about the next day. And so, you know, all of our individual abilities were all strong, but they meant nothing in the studio unless we had a strong, you know, collective concentration. And once we got back together with each other, we were able to create something good. And so I look at that song as it's very simple, but it's very emblematic of the whole experience of the record, where we, you know, had to really stay together and concentrate together in order to produce something.
Well, Patti Smith,
merit.
I know you have to go do Jay Leno. Another minute, though, just you lived in Detroit from 1980 to, I believe, 1988. You were married.
No, from 1979 until 1996.
Oh, Boy, you were, well, our paths should have crossed more often. You were married to Fred Sonic Smith, the late Fred Smith, who died tragically at a young age, part of the incredible MC5 that put, in many ways, that type of rock and roll on the map. Are you marked at all by your time in Detroit?
Well, it's part of who I am. You know, I learned so much. Fred was a Detroit man. He loved Detroit, and I learned so much from him. I learned, you know, so much about music and politics, golf, aeronautics, about, you know, the history of America. He was a great teacher, and he was the father of our children, and both born in Detroit. So every day I look upon my son and daughter there. They were born at St. John's Hospital in Detroit. We are, no matter where we are, we're a Detroit family. And I it was some of the happiest days of my life. I lived there. And, I'm not a real Detroiter. I almost feel like a world citizen because I travel so much. But it was one of, you know, the pivotal times of my life. And those times will always walk with me.
Well, Patti Smith, thanks so much for being on the Peter Werby Show. I suspect the Columbia guy now is saying, like, come on, we got
to... Oh, it's okay. I mean, I have to go and... and happy May Day.
It is.
I don't know when this will air, but it is May Day, and it's the workers' holiday. We salute all the workers, and it was really nice to talk to you, and I hope everybody likes the record. I did this record really... for people to listen to. I didn't want to make a difficult record that was hard to penetrate. You know, I can do that anytime. The challenge for this record was to do a record that, you know, was accessible to people and that they could really hear the lyrics of some of these great artists. So I hope they like it, and happy May Day.
Well, happy May Day to you, Patti Smith. Give them hell on Jay Leno. Sing those songs, and we'll get some more on the air right now for you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. It's wonderful talking to you. And, yes, indeed, let's do another cut. How about a Jimi Hendrix? It starts the album. And this was one I was saying, whoa, Jimi Hendrix so belongs to Jimi Hendrix. Tell me it doesn't now belong to Patti Smith as well.
Can't just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea.
such a mess.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a lovely day outside as I record this interview, but we're all concerned about the climate. Suddenly we realize there is such a thing as global warming, at least about 90% of us do. There's a lot more to it, though. It's a very complex question, and what is ahead may be threatening, at least challenging, or both. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is Fred Pierce. His book is With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. And Fred Pierce is a former news editor at New Scientist, currently that magazine's environment and development consultant. He's written for Audubon, Popular Science, Time, the Boston Globe, and Natural History. His books include When the Rivers Run Dry, Keepers of the Spring, Turning Up the Heat, and Deep Jungle. He lives in England. He's here promoting his brand new book. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Yeah, Peter, hi, thanks.
Well, you know, there's still, why is there still a debate about this? We still, it's almost like there's a legitimate other side, that there is no global warming, that this is just sort of, you know, climate variation. Is there a debate?
Not much of one. I mean, you'll always find scientists who will chivvy away, who will criticize each other and find fault with what each other are saying. But, I mean, in my experience, there's more agreement about the basic science of climate change than there is about almost any other field, certainly in the environmental sciences. The number of skeptics are really very few, and most of them aren't, if you like, natural scientists. I mean, they're not physicists and chemists and climate scientists. They're, you know, they're going to be more social scientists and economists with their own particular take on things. So within the, if you like, the climate science community, there's a high level of agreement about the basic facts of it, you know, that we're causing global warming and why we're causing global warming and the kind of direction that it's likely to go in. I think there's a considerable uncertainty about, if you like, some of the more worrying aspects of things that might happen but might not. And part of the, well, quite a lot of the book is about exploring some of those issues, some of those tipping points, so that those positive feedbacks, as the scientists sometimes talk about them. So there are, you know, there are uncertainties out there, but the basic science is really pretty clear now.
Why has this become politicized, that it seems like the people that are skeptical about, public figures at least, that are skeptical about global warming tend to be conservatives or on the far right wing, and they kind of see it as some, in fact, Rush Limbaugh has said this is all just a plot to take away your SUVs.
Well, yeah, it might take away your SUVs, I suppose, unless we can find more efficient SUVs. Maybe that, you know, that's something to get the auto companies on. But if you like, the science is the science is the science. If the science tells us that we are warming the planet and that this is a threat to our way of life, then that's the case, whether it is a threat to SUVs or not. So, I mean, Russ has and many people have that kind of political take on it. They see the consequences and they don't like them. But I don't think the sensible response to not liking the consequences is to deny the science. If the science is good, and my judgment is that the science is pretty good, as I say, there are some uncertainties in some areas, but the broad thrust is pretty clear.
Fred Pierce, your book, With Speed and Violence, has as the subtitle, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. I think, to me, the most frightening phrase in there is tipping point. Does that suggest that there is a point at which there may be no return?
I think probably not one. I think there are lots, and therefore, you know, if we miss one, then we can try and prevent other ones. But there are, if you like, scary monsters out there, which is what some of the scientists call them, monsters that could be awakened by global warming. One of the things that the scientists are really finding worrying now, and I picked up an awful lot while researching the book, was the fear that by warming the planet, we're going to release natural reservoirs of some of the critical greenhouse gases. So we know, I guess a lot of people will know about the rainforest. Well, obviously they're made of carbon. If the rainforests die or burn, that carbon will get into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, and that's going to warm the planet some more. So that's a worry. That's a potential way of amplifying a global warming effect. But there are other things. The soils also contain large amounts of carbon. A lot of scientists are worried that the soils are going to start releasing this stuff in large amounts. Again, could add to global warming, make it go faster. And of course, that extra warming could release more carbon dioxide and cause more warming, and you have a dangerous kind of runaway effect. And that's the real fear. And there are a number of other areas where things of that sort could happen. But it's not a single, I don't think it's a single on-off switch. There's always, you know, we can all, anything that we do now is going to make things better in future than they would otherwise be. We're already going to have a fair amount of global warming. There's not much that we can do to stop it. Well, we've seen some of it already, I think, in the early stages of it. But we can stop some of the scarier things happening later on. How soon do we have to act to do that? I don't think anybody really knows that, so probably the best thing to do is act as fast as we can.
Now, when we talk about climate variation, I know, and I don't mean to keep politicizing this, but I look at these conservative sites, and they're laughing because at some point their Al Gore was at a conference on global warming. It was earlier this month in April, and they said it was like there was 2 feet of snow or something like that. In other words, that mocking the fact here we thought there was going to be global warming. And in fact, it was cold as hell.
Well, yeah, for heaven's sake, there's always going to be weather. What we're talking here is about average temperatures going up and the implications for that. I mean, nobody's saying that there's not going to be weather, that there's not going to be natural variability. A lot of it's one of the things that skeptics do quite a lot is to say, well, look, the weather's naturally variable. We've had natural variability of climate in the past. We've had ice ages in the past. We've had warm periods. We've had cold periods. Therefore, they seem to suggest we don't need to worry about man-made climate change. I don't buy that at all. The more variability I see in climate naturally, the more it makes me think that there are kind of levers in the climate system, if I can put it that way, that we are in danger of pulling that could cause very fast and very dramatic climate change. In other words, the more natural variability there is, the more it makes me worry about the kind of changes that we might produce by our man-made version of climate change.
Well, Fred Pierce, frequently people point to just sort of the generalized term pollution, and a good case study, and I know there's cities like this in England where you're from, like Manchester and places, and we had Pittsburgh, that they had to turn the streetlights on during the day. There was such terrible pollution, and they cleaned it up.
Yeah.
So is it? It's not as simple as that, though, is it?
Well, it's not simple, but it does show that we can do things. I mean, I'm not quite old enough to remember it, but it's certainly within my lifetime that London still had the big pea super smogs. And everybody used to say, oh, well, they're natural. We've always had fogs, so what's the big deal? It's not really man-made things. We've always had fogs. And they used to say, and anyway, it would be far too expensive and far too difficult to do anything about them, to try and stop them. And that, you know, that kind of attitude persisted for a long time. And then they had a really big smog. It was in 1952, I think, in which 10,000 people died within a week as a result of this smog. And you had similar things in Pittsburgh. It's not unique, but London was certainly a big example. And at that point, everybody more or less said, oh, sorry, enough is enough. We've got to do something about it. And they did. They got over it. It was a tipping point in the political system. They just said, no, sorry, we've got to do something about it. It may prove, which it didn't prove, very expensive, but, you know, they said, well, regardless of the cost, we've got to do something about it. We can't let this carry on. And they did, and within 10 years, they'd stopped the smogs happening. And, you know, that's happened around the world. I mean, we have auto smogs of one sort or another, but we don't have those coal-fired smogs that we used to have in the old days. Everybody's decided that simply should not be allowed. And while stopping global warming is probably going to be more difficult, I think once we set our mind to it, we can do these things. And generally speaking, once we set our mind to do things, we find that they're much less costly than we thought of to start with.
Let's go back to the subtitle of your book, With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. The fear would suggest that we're not going to make a large enough effort to intervene. Because when I hear people say we have to reduce this by reductions by 2080 or 2050, it would seem to me, I suspect you would agree, that we ought to have some goals like 2010, right?
Yeah. Well, in Europe we do, because we signed up to the Kyoto Protocol. But I think that the next, if you like, the son of Kyoto is likely to be based around 2020. And I think we're going to have a series of targets of one sort or another playing out beyond then. And I think certainly in Europe, and I think to some extent in North America as well, corporations are starting to call for these because they're saying, look, we have to plan infrastructure which is going to be still in business in 2040. You know, we're planning power stations now which will still be generating energy in 2040. We need to know what the playing field's going to be. We need to know what the rules are going to be. And they're calling for the targets to be produced so that they know where they are. And some of them are calling for tough targets as well because they think they can make money out of cleanup. It could be tough, but I think there is a potential, just as there was in the days when we were getting rid of the pea super smogs or the coal smogs. I think there is potential to get on a sort of cycle of positive virtue where everybody sees that there's a benefit for them in joining the game of cleaner energy and more efficient energy and all the things that we need to do in order to really crack this problem. And it is a major challenge. To stop global warming, we're going to have to reduce our emissions globally, not just in the rich world, but globally by 60 or 70%. Now, that's a huge ask. But even if we only reduce them by 30 or 40%, we would have a major effect in reducing the speed of global warming. And in many respects, it's going to be the speed that's the real problem when it comes to, you know, the practical business of coping with it.
Well, this is a good optimistic streak in Fred Pierce.
I do my best.
Because, you know, so much in your book with Speed and Violence is, what did you say the scientists call them, scary monsters? Tell us about some of these scary monsters. I just looking through your book and reading some of the summaries of them, they are truly frightening. We see like the beginning of the collapse of some of these glaciers or the melting of them in northern Montana. Fill some of that in a little.
Well, I mean, most of the glaciers around the world are melting away, literally. And sometimes they're sort of physically breaking up. But, I mean, they're disappearing. There are very few glaciers around the world that are growing. One or two where snowfall's getting greater, but not many. Most of the world's glaciers are disappearing. Now, the glaciers in mountains were going to have a relatively small effect on sea level rise. The really big risk as regards sea levels is going to be what happens in the big ice sheets up in Greenland and Antarctica. So while glaciers are going to, I mean, they're going to have effect on things like the Great Lakes, undoubtedly. I mean, I can't predict what it'll be, but they're very likely have effect on the level of water in the Great Lakes. But at the global level, at the ocean level, it's the big ice sheets on Greenland and on Antarctica. These are huge. I mean, they have the ice is 2 miles thick and covers just, you know, hundreds and thousands of kilometers. So these are, and if they go, then sea level rise, you'd be measuring it in meters. If the Greenland ice cap went, it would be 7 meters. If the West Antarctic ice cap went, it would be another 7 meters. And scientists are beginning to worry that these things might happen, maybe not in my lifetime, but in the next couple of centuries.
Remind people what a meter is. We're still...
My apologies. Well, a meter is 3 feet. So if you're losing 7 meters, you're talking about 24, 25 feet.
Yeah, that would...
quite a lot.
That would say goodbye to Bangladesh and Manhattan and a lot of islands. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I think probably the studio I'm sitting in Washington at this very moment will probably be flooded by that as well. So, but look, what they used to say, what some of the scientists do still say, is that these ice sheets are like huge, vast blocks of ice, and they will only melt slowly, if you like, from the top down. But what a lot of glaciologists are saying to me now, and they were telling me very fervently while I was doing the research for this book, is that the ice caps aren't really like that. They're actually rather fractured. They have cracks in them, and that if you start melting water at the top, and you get big lakes that form on these ice sheets in the summer now, the water goes right down to the bottom and gets between the ice and the rock beneath, and you're sort of destabilizing the whole of these ice sheets. They can measure them moving now in the summer when you get ice at the surface. Ice goes down the cracks, the crevasses in the ice, goes down to the bottom. They can measure the ice cap, I think, a mile or two thick, physically lifting up by a couple of feet and starting to move. And they are fearful that rather than ice caps melting very slowly over 1,000 years or more, they may actually physically break up much more quickly in timescales of decades or centuries. And that's really much more alarming because that'll make sea level rise happen much faster. And we, you know, we won't really have time to head for the hills.
Well, you you talk about the history, and this is a quote from the book, the history of our planet's climate shows that it does not do gradual change under pressure, whether from sunspots or orbital wobbles or the depredations of human. It lurches virtually overnight, and that kind of scary monsters always sort of scare me. So that
that's right. I mean the work that's been done literally in the last 5 years looking at climate history shows exactly that, that climate changes suddenly. You get long periods of things being pretty stable, and then suddenly they go whoop, you just kind of it flips. And when they discovered that temperatures in the North Atlantic region, and that includes Europe and east coast of the U.S., changed by about 20 degrees Fahrenheit within a decade, 20 degrees Fahrenheit within a decade, about 11,000 years ago, just a really sudden jump in temperatures. Now, we don't exactly know what caused that, but, you know, we can guess about some of the features of it. But at the very least, it suggests that the climate system does work in lurches. And now, if humans don't intervene, that doesn't mean that we don't get lurches, but I think if humans do intervene in the way that we are, it makes the chances of lurches sometime soon much greater.
Well, could we at any point be facing the worst imaginable scenario? I mean, almost an obliteration of life on Earth, or even a smaller version of that where you live in England. Of course, the whole area is warmed by, what do they call the, I forgot what it is now.
The Gulf Stream.
The Gulf Stream, about this sort of a hydraulic effect, and that could stop, and all of a sudden you guys would have permanent winter.
Well, we could, I mean, you might argue that if we're going to have global warming, that if the Gulf Stream switched off, as some scientists predict might happen, and that cooled us back down again, then we're back where we started, and that might be an ideal solution. That may well be true. That unfortunately, if the Gulf Stream switched off, it would probably also stop the Asian monsoon, and unfortunately 2 billion people on the planet rely on that for their food, so that wouldn't be terribly good news at a kind of planetary level. But there are these a whole series of these things that do seem to change quite suddenly, and there's been quite a lot of research done over the years to suggest that the Gulf Stream is one of those things that just can flip on and off. I think there are others. Some people believe that in a warmer world we might have permanent El Ninos, and that would have a very big effect on the west coast of the U.S. and in parts of Asia and Australia as well. So again, there are quite big potentials for quite sudden and abrupt change, which could be very disruptive. But I look at it this way. I mean, it does seem that that the whole of human society, really, as we know it, which has developed since the end of the last ice age 10,000 years ago. That's the time when we developed farming and cities and everything else that we've done, really. And that's all happened in a period of very stable climate. And it may be, I'm pretty certain, that stable climate has been a big reason why we've been able to do all these things. When we've planted crops, we've pretty much known that, you know, they'll grow and that we can harvest them the next year. We build a city on a coast, we pretty much know that it won't flood the next year because sea levels are fairly stable. All those kind of things. And I think that kind of certainty is rapidly disappearing. Now, how will we cope with that? I don't know. I mean, we think we're quite smarter than we can handle most of these things. But then you look at the response to Katrina. Now, I don't know whether Hurricane Katrina was caused by global warming or not, and that's not really my point. My point is that one hurricane, wow, we couldn't cope with that. We still haven't. You know, the city's still a mess there. How would we cope with lots of climate events of that sort? I think we're more vulnerable to uncertain climate than we may think. And therefore, many of the features of our society, not just in the poor world, who are obviously more vulnerable because they're more dependent on the rainfall to grow their crops every year and they don't have the cash to buy something else if the rains fail. Not just them. People in the rich world, people in the developed world, people in the industrialized world, we too face threats, and we too may find it harder to cope than we think.
My guest is Fred Pierce on the Peter Werby Show. The book is With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. It is published by Beacon Press. You can go to beacon.org. And Fred Pierce, I didn't ask you before the interview began. Is there another website that you would like me to send people to as well? And I will link it on my site if there is.
I don't have have my own website, but I put out a regular blog on the New Scientist website. That's the magazine that I work for regularly, not full time, but regularly. And that's www.newscientist.com. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of good stuff in there, and there's a section on climate change in there, too.
Tell us, we were talking about the hydraulic, the ending of the hydraulic effect of the Gulf Stream and what that would produce. You also talk about how global warming could flip the Sahara Desert back into a wet phase that it left abruptly like 5,000 years ago,
yeah,
when there was a cooling period.
Yeah, climate change needn't all be bad news. I think the suddenness and abruptness of it will catch us by surprise and cause problems, but there could be some good stories in there, and one of which could be a wetter Sahara. We know, for instance, that the Sahara does seem to be on a kind of one of these tipping points. We know that about 6,000 years ago, the Sahara was a wet area. There were huge wadis, and there were, you know, right in the middle of the desert, there were great lakes and crocodiles, and you know, the full works. It was a kind of tropical paradise, if you like. But almost overnight, certainly within a century, and maybe much quicker than that, it just flipped into a desert situation. It looks like there were a couple of dry years. Vegetation died. Without vegetation, the rainfall reduced further, and it got into a kind of cycle where it just could never recover. And it's been like that ever since, effectively. It may be that global warming will allow the rains from the coastal regions to penetrate a bit further into Africa, into the heart of Africa, and might trigger a regeneration. Rains might cause vegetation, which might cause more rain, which we could get into a positive cycle there. I'm not making a prediction. I don't know. Some scientists think it could go the other way and the Sahara could expand. But there's a potential there. So there could be some news, good news stories. It's just I don't know quite which ones they are.
Fred Pierce, we're almost out of time, and maybe it would be good to, rather than ending with scary monsters, pick up on your earlier theme and about the possibilities for the Sahara in terms of optimism. Now, we talked about how London and Pittsburgh and other cities have attacked pollution, but as I said earlier, it seems to me that this ought to be recognized as a planetary crisis, and that governments and corporations ought to respond to it, but all institutions are pretty resistant to great change.
They are, but I do see a sign of change. I can certainly see it in the U.S. I was last here 2 years ago, and I can feel that the nature of the political debate, well, there is a political debate about climate change where there really wasn't 2 years ago. It's beginning to feed into the presidential elections as I see it, and could become very important. It's up for discussion at the UN Security Council this autumn. It's rising up the political agenda in lots of different ways, and the G8 is going to be talking about it. I think most political leaders now realize that they can't avoid this one. I think one of the changes was the report called the Stern Report, which came out in the UK last autumn, which pointed out for the first time that climate change is not just about polar bears and ice caps. It's about the global economy, and it's about, Stern was predicting that the global economy could collapse by 30% within a couple of decades because of global warming. Now, that really concentrates the minds of politicians. They know that handling the economy is one of their central tasks. I think that's one of the reasons why politicians are coming forward. And I think corporations are coming forward, too, and I think we as citizens have to come forward as well. There has to be an ethical debate about this. There has to be a corporate debate about this. There has to be a debate among economists and politicians. And I think we may be reaching the tipping point. I'm a born optimist. I think we may be reaching the tipping point where the political system flips. And if we can get in ahead of the natural system flipping, then we can deal with this.
Well, I am. You're a lot more optimistic than I am, and I like that because, I mean, their attitudes, I mean, based on observations, of course, and what have you, but, and I know you would agree with this, and you added to that. I mean, I don't think that we as citizens can just depend on the elites of world society for this change, that there's got to be popular community-based action as well.
If the corporations change, it'll be because they feel that we've changed and that they've got to move with us, and I think the politicians will change for similar reasons. Listen, I'm in my super optimistic days, and I do have these sometimes, I think that in 50 years' time, we'll be looking back at now and thinking, well, what was the fuss? We had the technical ability to solve the problem. It wasn't too expensive. We got it. We went out there, and we did it. And we just kind of flipped the system. In 50 years' time, we could all be reliant on non-fossil fuels. We could not be burning coal in large quantities. We could not be burning oil in large quantities. We can probably burn a fair amount of gas fairly safely. If we could just do that, we could solve the problem. And in 50 years' time, we might have solved it.
The book is Fred Pierce. The book is With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. Beacon Press is the publisher, beacon.org. It'll also be a link to it on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Fred Pierce, thank you so much for being on my show.
Thanks, Peter.
All right.
You're listening to WRIF.com.